Order. I want to welcome everyone in the audience to discuss this important topic tonight and express a special appreciation to my co-chair, Representative Krieger, and the other members of our work group, Representative McPherson and Senator Beyer, who produced the package that is before us today, and our staffer, Heidi Moad, who did most of the work on the issue. This is an important issue that we have facing us today, and we will dispense with comments from our panel and get right into the discussion of these bills. Thank you. Representative Krieger.
Okay, first we'd like to have Representative Boquist and Senator Johnson come up together, please.
Thank you, sir.
You better put that chair out for her.
This is an officer and a gentleman.
And you'll break my neck, Mr. Chairman.
Senator, you are a team member.
Thank you very much, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Betsy Johnson. I have the privilege of representing Senate District 16. You are going to hear from two of my constituents tonight that I think are going to provide very compelling testimony. Alan Evans and his colleagues from an organization called Thugs Off Drugs, I think, is going to give you a very eye-opening presentation. I will not interrupt their presentation to say more, other than I have been asked to offer two pieces of testimony into the record from constituents. One is the mayor of Klatskanai, Oregon, a small rural community, and the gist of her message is that this is not an issue that can be deferred to another time. She has asked me to read a very compelling and very short letter into the record, and I'm going to do so. Retired Sheriff Al Eastman and his wife Faye had retired to the community of Klatskanai to remodel an old farmhouse and live in what was a historically quiet and safe area. On February the 25th, 2004, while checking on noises in a neighbor's house, Sheriff Eastman was killed. He was killed by a man in his 20s, high on methamphetamine and hiding in the vacant house after committing the crime. This is Mrs. Eastman's letter. Dear Chair Krieger, I live in Columbia County and was personally affected by the epidemic of homemade methamphetamine that has found its way into rural communities like mine. My husband was shot and killed by a young man on methamphetamine. This young man became an unpredictable meth user, an entrance into a world that produces killers. Their behavior on meth drugs is dangerous. They show no mercy and will hook anyone to finance their drug need. They will rob anyone, and heartbreaking home and business robberies set the scene for ID theft, putting them into the high-tech crime arena to finance their drug habit. I am proud that our local and state community has pulled together and developed a coordinated approach to crack down on local meth labs and increase prevention, education, and access to treatment. However, as budgets are already tight, additional resources are urgently needed to stop the costly effect caused by drug dealers and drug manufacturers, as well as to expand treatment and prevention programs. Laws need to be put into place to address this epidemic of methamphetamine in Oregon and to protect the innocent, punish the guilty, and provide treatment to those who are willing. I urge you to pass legislation that will help accomplish this and move our state out of the number one position of states affected by meth. Sincerely yours and respectfully, Faye Eastman. This, I think, is a poignant testimonial to the scourge of meth in rural communities, particularly those of us that represent forested areas. I have brought with me and will enter into the record, with the chair's permission, letters from a mother of a talented and a daughter with great prospects until she fell into the clutches of this drug and is now unwelcome in her family's home. It's another, I'm sure, of a series of stories that you are going to hear tonight, lending poignant testimony to why it is we need to do something to deal with the problem of meth in Oregon. And so with that, Madam Chair, I will close, commend to you the presentation of Mr. Evans and Thugs Off Drugs, and wish you and all of us Godspeed in finding a solution to this problem before it tears our state apart.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Chair, for the record, I am Brian Boquist. I represent the 23rd House District, and I was going to appear today with a good friend and family friend of mine, Ron Saxton, but unfortunately didn't come back from Alaska. I did, enter into for testimony his letter, and I want to kind of paraphrase the concerns that we had in regard. As you're well aware of, the Ag and Natural Resources Committee has already passed out a bill that deals with the fertilizer dye issue. I also introduced House Bill 3105, which because of the cost didn't get anywhere yet. I believe Senator Whitsett and others and I have had discussions in regard to that synchronization. One of the key things, of course, is the precursor substances that make up methamphetamine, as the pseudoephedrine, which you know, the iodine matrix. One of the challenges we face in the five counties that I have and that we have around the state is the simple fact that we're out of jail space and we're out of the ability to manage this at the local level. One of the problems that you have specifically in addressing this issue is when we have a criminal sentence that is a year or less, as you know, the counties are stuck trying to figure out how to deal with this. Back on House Bill 3105 that I introduced, we tried to come up with a resourcing mechanism to fund that. And so I would strongly encourage you to review Ron Saxon's letter, and I would also point out again that the issue that we have at hand is if we don't have a sentence longer, say 18 months or 2 years, on the issues of the precursor substances that are out there, then you're going to be saddling the counties, specifically my five counties, and we can't handle it right now. And you go to places in my school districts, and I have superintendents and school board members not asking for more education money. They're asking us to address the meth problem. What we need to be doing is jailing the manufacturers and treating the users. And I would encourage all of the good actions this committee has taken and would encourage you to move forward with a bill that helps the counties and helps address this issue across the state. Thank you, Mr. Chair, Madam Chair.
Heidi Moad is going to give us just a brief rundown of the two bills.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Madam Chair and members of the committees. Essentially, we have two bills before us tonight, House Bill 2485 and Senate Bill 907. Of those two bills, House Bill 2485 has the -2 amendments that are up for your consideration tonight, and Senate Bill 907 has the -3 amendments up for your consideration tonight. Both amendments essentially replace the original bills, although there are pieces of each of them in the amendments. House Bill 2485, if amended by the committee, will be dealing with methamphetamine labs and waste, precursor substances, food stamp benefits, and drug courts. As regards the meth labs and waste, the bill will clarify public nuisance and abatement laws. It will expand the crimes of arson in the first and second degrees to include methamphetamine-related fires and explosions, and creates a new crime of possessing or disposing of methamphetamine manufacture waste. As regards the precursor substances, it creates immunity for persons who report possession of or transactions involving precursor substances if that person has reasonable grounds to believe that the possession or transaction is unlawful. It creates a new crime of distribution of equipment, a solvent, a reagent, or a precursor substance with the intent to facilitate the manufacture of a controlled substance. It creates a crime of unlawful possession of lithium metal or sodium metal. It modifies the crime of theft in the first degree to include theft of precursor substances, which, if we do not do that, the theft of precursor substances would remain value-based and typically a Class C misdemeanor, theft in the third degree. It modifies the crimes of unlawful possession and delivery of ephedrine, pseudoephedrine, and phenylpropanolamine. In reviewing the draft, I do need to point out that I don't believe that the drafted amendments completely reflect the work group's desires, and that is to say that as regards the unlawful possession, the amendments say the person may still possess up to 9 grams, and they may have more if prescribed by a doctor. However, it did clearly reflect the work group's intent as regarded the unlawful distribution, because it made it unlawful to sell anything containing pseudoephedrine unless it was in a gel cap or liquid form. It goes on also to clarify that the Board of Pharmacy can regulate those gel caps and liquids in the future should it become an issue, establishes procedures for those sale transaction logs, and creates the crime of failing to make or maintain the transaction records. It modifies the crime of unlawful possession of iodine in its elemental form and creates a crime of unlawful distribution of iodine in its elemental form, and does the same two things regarding iodine matrices. It clarifies procedures for sale transaction logs involving methyl sulfonyl methane, and adds lithium and sodium metals to the list of precursor substances. It modifies that crime of failure to report a precursor substance transaction, and it provides authority to the Department of Agriculture and the Oregon State Police to work together to oversee the development of a non-toxic dye that could be added to anhydrous ammonia. And if that development occurs, it would provide immunity to persons who manufacture, sell, or possess anhydrous ammonia with that dye added. As regards food stamp benefits, it clarifies that the Department of Human Services has the ability to suspend an individual's food stamp benefits upon the recommendation of their supervising officer if that person has been convicted of manufacture or delivery of a controlled substance and there is evidence that the person traded their food stamp benefits for controlled substances. It provides a mechanism for reinstatement and requires the consideration of any dependent persons receiving those benefits as well. And finally, it grants the authority to the Criminal Justice Commission to oversee the grant funding of drug courts in Oregon. Senate Bill 907, the -3 amendments would do the following. It would modify the crime of criminal mistreatment in the first degree to clarify that a dependent or elderly person who is left in a place where controlled substances are manufactured would also violate the statute. It modifies the crime of child neglect in the first degree to include leaving a, that's an error on the SMS. It modifies the crime of child neglect in the first degree to include leaving a child in a place where controlled substances are manufactured and directs the Criminal Justice Commission to elevate the offense to a level 6 on the sentencing guidelines grid if that controlled substance is methamphetamine. It adds to the definition of child abuse for the purposes of mandatory reporting the exposure to a controlled substance that results in a drug-affected child. It clarifies law enforcement's ability to access certain health records when a child has been present in a place where meth was manufactured or used. And it clarifies the court's authority to suspend child visitation rights when the parent abuses controlled substances and visitation time is therefore not in the child's best interest. As for sentencing, it creates a new sentencing guidelines classification of 30 grams or more of a marketable or ingestible quality of methamphetamine and directs the Criminal Justice Commission to classify that as a level 9 on the sentencing guidelines grid. It also directs the Criminal Justice Commission to classify manufacture of methamphetamine at level 6 if that manufacturer involves chemical reactions. And the idea there is that the manufacturer definition is very broad and includes packaging and repackaging, and the work group felt that it was not appropriate to punish that behavior in the elevated manner as to manufacture. It also creates a repeat offender sentencing scheme, and that's pretty detailed, so I'm going to ask you to just review your SMSs instead of kind of trying to list that out and explain it today or right now. It establishes or appropriates funds to the Attorney General's office to supplement their district attorney assistance program by allowing them to hire 2 new attorneys and 1 analyst to assist jurisdictions throughout Oregon with methamphetamine-related prosecutions. It provides the Department of Corrections the ability to convert their military-modeled alternative incarceration program to a treatment-intensive one if they believe that conversion would better serve the needs of their inmate population. And then the last thing that it does is currently in Oregon, ORS 475992 is the statute under which all drug manufacture, delivery, and possession crimes are charged. And as a result, statistics have been very difficult. Therefore, you will probably hear a number of times that obtaining an accurate fiscal impact statement is also going to be very difficult to obtain because we don't know how many meth-related offenses there have been in Oregon, and we will have to rely on anecdotal evidence from county to county. So what this would do is break all of those out based on the whether it's a manufacture, a delivery, or a possession, and based on which drug is involved so that we can better track in the future drug trends in the state.
You got it done?
That's it. That's all it does.
That's quite a summary, isn't it?
Okay, our first witness tonight is Craig Prince. And Craig Campbell.
Craig Madam Chair, for the record, my name is Craig Campbell. I'm with the Governor's Office. First of all, I'll be very brief with my initial comments. I just want to applaud the group that's put together the legislation that's coming before you. It is one of those rare opportunities where a huge issue has come before the legislature, and working in a cooperative and bipartisan manner, you've managed to put together a pretty substantial piece of work. But with that, I am tonight going to play the part of Dr. Richard Rawson. Unfortunately, I am not a doctor, so I will do my best to provide you with the information that he provided to you a couple of months ago in Pendleton with some additional information as I go along. I'm also sensitive to the fact that you have a lot of other people who are going to be testifying tonight, so I have no pride of I'm willing to step down from the stand at any time. If you think I need to go faster, just say, Mr. Campbell, you pick it up. I'd be happy to do it. What I'm going to provide you today is a very in-depth, in some instances, overview of the way the brain reacts to methamphetamine and what sort of actions can be taken in order to try to effectively treat those who have become addicted to methamphetamine. With that, I need to once again say that the information that I'm presenting was initially presented by Dr. Richard Rawson and David Geffen, both from the University of UCLA and University of California at Los Angeles. Obviously, the methamphetamine problem is something that is not particular to the Pacific Northwest or to Oregon. It's a statewide, nationwide, and worldwide problem. I'm not going to belabor that point. I'm going to go through some of these rather quickly. In 2002, 19 states had rates in excess of the national rate of 52 admissions. This is for treatment for methamphetamine. 10 were in the West, 7 were in the Midwest, 2 were in the South. You notice there are no states in the East. Oregon, however, was the highest, with 324 admissions, leading Hawaii, which is a bit surprising considering the amount of crystal methamphetamine problem that they have in that state. But as you can see, most of the states are on the west side of the country. Now, what science has allowed us to do is get a much better picture of exactly what happens inside the brain when it is dealing with methamphetamine. Major reason people like to do drugs is because they like what it does to their brains, the way they think and the way their brain operates while it's on drugs. After a while, however, they become addicted to the drug. They can't stop because it changes the way their brains operate. The longer the use of the drug operates, the more substantial and fundamental the change in the brain is, and the more long-lasting the ramifications for that change. Most people, when they first start, are just hoping to change the way that they feel. However, after they've had an opportunity to take the drug and become addicted, it is too late at that point in time, and it has long-term effects on their brains. Now, what I'm going to do, and again, this is the part where I'm not a doctor, but I play one today, is I'm going to take you through those areas of the brain that methamphetamine affects. First is the frontal lobe. The frontal lobe is the section of the brain that transitions messages that allow you to move and do coordination. The limbic system is the system that sends neurotransmitters to tell you that you're feeling well, that you're hungry, that gets you aroused, gets you interested in things like that. The hippocampus is a specific part of the limbic system that focuses on short-term memory. Most of that short-term memory is attached to your ability to speak those memory thoughts. So when you're thinking about something, you're trying to remember something, you utter it, that's the hippocampus at work. I'm going to talk to you a little bit about the way different things affect the pleasure centers of the brain and how it releases dopamine. There's a series of charts that are going to follow. This is the one that kind of gives it all at once. Normally, your brain is operating at 100% based on what you have on the table in front of you. When you eat food, that raises to about 150% of your dopamine levels, especially if it's a good meal. I don't mean to be indiscreet, but if you are engaged in sexual activity, that can raise up to around 200 points or 200% of the dopamine level in your body. Cocaine, interestingly enough, can bring you up to over 400 points. Nicotine, about 250. Morphine, about 230. Amphetamine, specifically methamphetamine, as you can see, is a much different animal altogether. it creates a substantial increase in the amount of dopamine that is dumped into the system all at once. Now, dopamine is the neurotransmitter that makes you feel very, very good. It's the thing that makes you happy. I'm going to show you some specifics about how the trend works. You'll notice here that with food, some of that is in the anticipation of eating. You eat, and then, of course, over time, it dissipates. I'm not going to comment about sex. I've already done that tonight. Now, this is the interesting thing about amphetamine versus cocaine, morphine, not so much nicotine, but to a much higher extent. You'll notice that amphetamine, the high is extreme, and it is immediate. It hits right at the beginning and is very high, and then has a rather drastic drop-off period. Now, drastic comparatively, because you'll note that period of time is over an hour, and a methamphetamine high can last several hours. In fact, the total high can last as long as 12 hours. You'll note that cocaine is slower in the uptake and slower in the dissipation. Morphine, which is a softer drug, keeps you high longer, but there's no peak, so it's a much softer experience. Nicotine is much like amphetamine in the way it initially reacts. However, obviously, the dopamine released is much, much less. Now, the question is, why is it that after they start to use methamphetamine, why can't they stop? First, we're going to start looking at the effect on the brain and dopamine over time. You'll notice on the left, that portion of the brain, which is in the limbic system, that is the limbic system producing dopamine. Those brighter colors indicate that this particular brain is producing a lot of dopamine normally. However, after methamphetamine use, you notice that the dopamine levels are lower and they're more dissipated throughout the brain. This is a study that was done on monkeys to find out what the long-term ramifications of a intense but short-term dosage of dopamine, or I'm sorry, of methamphetamine has on the brain. All of the four top brain cross-sections are a healthy brain producing a normal amount of dopamine. After 4 weeks of use, after 10 days of use, then they did a study, a cross-section of the brain, and found after 4 weeks, you notice that there are no bright spots producing dopamine in the brain. After 6 months, no recovery at all. In fact, it's gotten a little bit worse. After a year, in some of the brains, you begin to see a level of dopamine production returning, and after 2 years, still not a great deal of improvement from what you see after 1 year. This told them two things. One, initially, there was a concern that dopamine production could never come back in those that had abused methamphetamine for a long period of time. Both through this study and from actual experience from those who have actually successfully gone through treatment of methamphetamine, we now know that it is possible for the brain to recover, although the length of use, the intensity of use, affect the long-term prognosis, and of course it's not consistent from person to person. But what it does mean is at least for a period of time, the brain is going to be substantially hindered in its ability to feel pleasure, and that of course translates to the way the person can react to anything around them. This is let me go to the next one. It's a little easier to explain. This is a nerve cell. This is a connection between what is called the axon, which is that big bulby part at the top, and the dendrite. This is how a brain cell transmits information, neurotransmitters, from one part of the brain to another. So when you're eating that nice meal, your brain sends a message to the axon, which then releases dopamine, which is then picked up by that dendrite, which is, I should be pointing to these things. This right here is the axon. This is the dendrite. The message is sent to the axon, which releases the dopamine into the synapse, which is this area here. It's then picked up by that receptor and held there. That's telling this receptor, you're happy, and it sends the message on down the line. The dopamine doesn't go away. It then is picked back up again by the axon. I'm hoping this next one will show it. Yes. So then, with these uptakes, picks back up that dopamine for it to be recycled again and used again. What happens with cocaine is cocaine actually plugs the uptake. And basically what it does is it tells the brain to keep the dopamine floating around a little while longer to continue to extend that pleasure that the brain is feeling and the message that it's sending. What happens with methamphetamine, which is different, however, methamphetamine is very much like the neurotransmitter norepinephrine. And as a result, it tricks the brain into, in that uptake, actually taking in the methamphetamine into the uptake, which then enters into the axon. It then goes to what's called a vesicle. That's where all the dopamine is created. It then destroys the vesicle, which releases the dopamine. It has two effects. One, it releases a lot of dopamine at once. And two, dopamine is toxic to the axon portion of the brain cell. So it destroys that axon so that it can no longer produce dopamine, which is why you see reduced dopamine levels in the slides I showed you earlier. That's not the only problem. Now, one thing I need to tell you about that, let me go back for a second. The way that methamphetamine works, the way a normal brain works, is that it has monitor cells. Those monitor cells are basically guiding you as an individual to tell you if you're hungry, and then whether or not it's satisfied. So what happens is you're hungry, so you eat something. The monitor cell says, look, food's on the way, go ahead and release the dopamine. It's actually the natural agent you have in your body that tells your brain to release dopamine. What methamphetamine does is it bypasses that monitor cell. It goes directly to the axon to release the dopamine. Well, what the axon does is after it's released dopamine, it sends a message back to the monitor cell. And it tells the monitor cell, message received, I've released the dopamine. Over time, what happens is that monitor cell keeps getting messages that dopamine's been released and it hasn't asked for it. So it essentially says, well, I'm not needed here, so it stops producing things that can send messages. What that does is it makes the brain dependent upon the methamphetamine to continue to release dopamine. The normal cycle of pleasure center activity is replaced by dopamine, which is why you have a very intensive addiction and why methamphetamine addicts cannot feel any sense of pleasure without going back to the drug over and over again. Now let's talk a little bit about the physical ramifications other than the mental effects. Obviously, when you're taking methamphetamine, not only does it increase brain activity, but it increases the physical activity of the body, particularly in the area of the heart and in the lungs. It increases your heart rate. It can create palpitations. It can create arrhythmia, which is an abnormal heart beating. It increases blood pressure and can, of course, create chest pain because your brain is working tremendously hard under the effects of the stimulant. The other things it does with respiratory problems, dyspnea, which is the feeling of shortness of breath, pulmonary hypertension, which is essentially your pulmonary system being restricted and being forced through the accelerated heart rate and things along those lines. And then there's pleuritic chest pain. The pleura is the sac around the lungs. Basically, all that means is you have pain while you're breathing. Of course, there are other pleasant side effects. Most of you have heard of meth mouth. It's not exclusive to the teeth. You can also get it in the eyes. What meth mouth is, essentially, it's not as a result of lack of calcium going to the teeth. It's actually as a result of either orally taking or sniffing methamphetamine. The chemical in methamphetamine actually wears away at the teeth, and over time what you get is something very much like the picture you have in front of you. I'm going to try and pretend that I know what an obstetric complication is, so you'll just have to accept that I gave you a brilliant answer of what that is, and unfortunately I wasn't able to actually get a doctorate in the last 24 hours, so I apologize for that. Obviously, weight loss. Unfortunately, with methamphetamine, for those who are using it for the first time and being introduced to the drug, the weight loss actually is an attraction for the use of the drug. Among school-age children, it's known as the Jenny Crank diet because it allows you to lose weight very quickly. And then there's speed bumps, which is also called formication. I want to make sure I pronounce that properly. Formication is essentially the feeling or the sensation that you have snakes or bugs on the skin. They often refer to it as crank bugs. This is exacerbated by the fact that those who are on methamphetamine often pick at what they perceive to be the bugs and create open sores, which in turn can be infected by staph and so forth. Obviously, methamphetamine, because it affects judgment, especially in the period of time after the high is over, individuals become very anxious. They become at times violent, and that can often create interpersonal problems that result in violence. Assault, gunshot, knife, judgment around motor vehicle use, and suicide attempts are all part of the potential problems associated with methamphetamine use over time. And again, essentially what happens is once you move to use methamphetamine, what initially is a voluntary choice becomes a switch of the brain, and at that point in time it becomes compulsory. Now, oftentimes methamphetamine is addictive at first use, and if it is not first use, it is almost certainly to be addictive on second use. So it's an extremely addictive drug, and it doesn't take very long to take hold. Again, it's primarily something that affects the brain, but it's not just a brain disease. It also has, it produces psychiatric problems as well. It creates a tremendous amount of paranoia. Obviously, because of the areas of brain it affects, it can actually damage long-term memory. It can create depression because, again, dopamine is no longer produced. It's very much like a water well. If you get water out of a well system and you drain that well system, you're not going to get the water that you used to be able to. You might get seepage, but you're not going to get the amount of water that you used to. It obviously creates hallucinations. Those people who are addicted to meth and are on the high are often awake and active for days at a time. So combined with the natural mind-altering effect of methamphetamine is the brain fatigue caused by being up for a long period of time. Psychotic reactions are, of course, also associated with that, as is panic and, of course, as I mentioned before, the rapid addictive ability of the drug. Now, you have treatment issues as well, because before you can effectively treat an individual who has been addicted to methamphetamine, you have to overcome a series of challenges that may not be present in other addictive behavior. I'm going to talk in a minute about acute overdoses and acute psychosis associated with methamphetamine, but you have the initial withdrawal, which can last for a very long time. And since it's highly addictive, the withdrawal is very difficult to get over, and there are people in this room who have gone through that who can explain it much better than I ever can. Of course, there's always the problem of initiating abstinence. There has to be an event that gets them to want to get off the drug in the first place. And, of course, there's always the challenge of relapse problems. There are cues that are created. The comparison that Dr. Rawson made was Pavlov's dog. When Pavlov fed his dog, he rang a bell, and then every time he rang a bell, the dog would salivate, anticipating that they were going to be eating dog food. Very much the same sort of Pavlovian responses are developed in methamphetamine addicts. There are certain smells, sights, events, locations that trigger that sort of response. The problem then becomes that when you try and get them off the drug, those responses are still there, so it becomes a treatment issue. You have to be able to address those triggers as part of treatment. And, of course, the other problem I talk about is that there's long-term brain problems that prevent you from cognitively dealing with the individual so that they can benefit from treatment. The acute overdose issues, of course, slowing of cardiac conduction. This is one of those I'm going to pass again. Ventricular irritability. Pass. Hypertensive episode. Basically what that means is that you have the heart beating very, very high, very, very strong rate. You have high blood pressure, which is putting incredible pressure on the bloodstream and on the, basically it's beginning to burst blood vessels because of the pressure of the blood going through the system. Hyperpyrexic episode, that's essentially the body temperature goes up. It's like a long-term high fever. And then, of course, seizures and anorexia, which is the long-term effect of the weight loss. There was a study done where individual animals were given the ability to tap for methamphetamine. After a while, the natural survival instincts were taken over by the methamphetamine addiction, and if not prevented, they would have actually starved themselves to death in order to get the methamphetamine. So again, anorexia is not abnormal because essentially their normal natural survival drives have been replaced by the addiction. And then, of course, there's the psychosis problems associated with it. Those people who have long-term addiction to methamphetamine have paranoid ideation, which basically just means that they have thoughts that are based on paranoia. They're out to get me. They may be very specific about these things. There may be particular groups or individuals who are out to get them. They may have well-formed delusions, what are often called shadow people. Oftentimes in those who are addicted to methamphetamine, especially after they've been up for a long period of time, will begin to make jerks as if they're looking at somebody who's behind them. That is their perception that the shadow people are behind them. They can see them just out of the corner of their eye, and they're taking a look to find out if they're there. hypersensitivity to environmental stimuli. Again, that's going back to the Pavlovian response I was talking about before. And then stereotypical behavior of tweaking, doing things over and over and over again in a repetitious fashion, taking clocks apart, doing things that are extremely focused. One individual who was trying to repair a particular part of their computer while tweaking ended up taking apart the entire computer in the process. And it's very difficult to divert them from that particular activity. Obviously, panic and extreme fearfulness that to some extent is connected to the paranoia. And then high potential for violence. Again, not every methamphetamine addict becomes violent, but especially with the advent of crystal meth into Oregon, we're seeing more and more episodes of violent responses of those people who are on methamphetamine. The withdrawal process, depression, fatigue, anxiety, energia, which basically means the opposite of energy. They're comatose, lethargic. Paranoia, as I mentioned before. Most of these I've gone over in some detail previously. Two approaches. One is a hospitalization approach if they're a danger to themselves or they have significant physical problems that need to be addressed. Otherwise, what is referred to as intensive outpatient treatment. I think the bill that you have before you has a program that has worked very effectively, which is drug courts. One of the problems we have is there's no pharmacotherapy. Pharmacotherapy, which essentially means that there's a drug that can be used to counteract the drug. Studies, there just have not been enough studies to find out if there are medications that can work to counteract the withdrawal symptoms of the drug. Largely that's because up until now, the federal government has not perceived methamphetamine abuse to be a large enough issue where they're willing to contribute money for studies. Some things are very basic. Constant, positive, reassuring support of the individual who is going through treatment becomes very important, especially since they tend to be very non-trustful. They're paranoid, and so that kind of constant positive reassurance is critical. However, you also have to be very directive in the way you're dealing with them because most of their abilities to conduct normal life functions have failed due to the addiction. So you have to be very directive. You have to keep them on a schedule. You have to give them very simple tasks to do to work through those things. Baby steps, essentially. Education regarding time course of system remission. Basically what that means is, look, you are not going to be able to feel pleasure for a long time. You need to know that up front, but you also need to know that hopefully you will get beyond that period of time so that they are not feeling hopelessness in addition to going through all the other challenges that they're going through with treatment. Sleep and nutrition. Obviously, their bodies have gone through a tremendous amount of damage. A lot of it is both physical as a result of failure to take in nutrition, but also because their bodies have not been given adequate amounts of sleep. So basic, simple messages like sleep and nutrition are critical. Low stimulation. Don't do things that are getting their mind working in other directions when you need to get them to focus on treatment. And then start to acknowledge the fact that they are feeling senses of paranoia and depression. A lot of this is problems that are also associated with this. One, they're starting out with depression, so getting them engaged is difficult. The cognitive impairment, again, it's difficult to get them to focus on the treatment. Because they're paranoid, it's very difficult to get them to trust, which is critical for treatment. Anhedonia, I actually knew yesterday. I don't know it today. I apologize for that. Obviously, behavioral and functional impairment brought about by brain damage, and then hypersexuality, which is a problem that is associated with the addiction itself. As one of the strange traits of methamphetamine addiction is a hypersexuality, a desire to be sexually active combined with an inability to do so. Conditioned cues, those are those Pavlovian response I was talking about, and then irritability and violence. Obviously, they are not feeling well. They would much rather be experiencing what they experienced when they were on meth, probably, and so they're going to be irritable during that period of time. So you have to have structure. You have to have the information in a way that is understandable at every stage of treatment, which means early on it has to be very, very basic. Family support is critical if they have it available because the more you can create a societal context and support group, the better off they're going to be. Positive reinforcement and, of course, 12-step or normal treatment participation is critical to this. I think, actually, most of what you're going to see in the rest of this is going to be repeat, so I'm going to go through the rest of the slides very quickly and get you to this one, which is the drug courts, which have all the elements I just described to you. It has proven much more successful than outpatient treatment, short-term treatment, which in fact is not designed to deal with methamphetamine treatment. The critical elements there are you have to have effective treatment in conjunction with that. You need to have the participation of the DA, the defense attorney. Obviously, the court. The court has to be able to impose immediate sanction. But you also have to have a structure that allows the treatment to happen long-term, meaning 18 months and even more. And it needs to happen in the context of the community where they're going to live so that they can learn how to deal with those Pavlovian stimuli that are out in that society, which is one of the reasons, and I apologize, I was unable to find the slide that showed that treatment in an incarcerated setting is not sufficient. You have to have post-incarcerated treatment, and a lot of it is specifically because they need to learn how to deal with society in a normal way, and they also have to deal with those cues when they're present. They can't do it in abstract while they're incarcerated. Of course, if you combine the two, much better, and you need to have a setting that to some extent is isolated or incarcerated prior to they can have the time they can have effective benefit from the treatment. I think with that, I am going to leave the rest of the presentation because there's a lot of other people, and I hope this was at least somewhat helpful to the committee, and I'd be able to be happy to answer any questions that a non-doctor would be able to.
Mr. Chair, in your medical training here, I think what we really most want to know is how much time does it take for someone to be away from the drug before they can start to experience normal pleasure?
From the information that from the information that Dr. Rawson provided previously, along with other information that's provided, it can be as early as 4 to 5 weeks, and at times it can be much, much longer, 3 to 4 months. So it depends on the individual, but there is a period of time that you have to go through. And then once they are capable of starting treatment, that doesn't mean that their switch is turned and they're able to take the full benefit of treatment. It, again, has to be stepped up over time. There are others, I'm sure, in the audience who will be testifying this evening who can answer that question better, who have gone through treatment, who provide treatment, and who are experienced in treatment models.
Committee members, you got any questions? You can lay them off that easy. Your hair is doing pretty good.
I actually already had a haircut, so thank you very much for noticing.
Thank you.
You did a great job, Dr. Campbell.
Walt Myers and Anna Peterson.
Rather than argue with the lady, I'll go first. My name's Walt Myers. Up until last Tuesday, I was the Salem police chief, and I was asked by the governor to chair the methamphetamine task force, statewide task force. When I first observed the effects of methamphetamine, I was a little bit confused, partly because home after home that I entered, the clothes were stacked on the floors, things were in such a disarray, there was no food available even when there were children present, the children were neglected, poorly cared for. Repeatedly we saw cases, one a week, two a week. The last report I got from the judge had been averaging about 2 a week born addicted to methamphetamine in Salem Hospital alone. Carry that over a period of years and see what that does to our educational system. Those kids end up in a classroom. You saw the brain damage that it does to an adult brain. The permanence of the damage is much more severe in the brain of a forming child inside of its mother's uterus as they're being developed. So I was confused as to how this drug could steal so much, and Craig well covered what causes that. We enjoy food, and that dopamine in our brain literally affects our decision making and our emotions and our memory so much that we can really be affected by our last meal, and we can be practically addicted to food. Sex, of course, a stronger drive, a more satisfying human experience, and then we go to cocaine, which for my many years as a field police officer was the king of drugs. people would do just about anything to get cocaine if they were addicted to it. And then to imagine, and this was sort of a revelation to me, when the experts explained to us in our task force how cocaine, yes, addictive, sex, food, but compared to methamphetamine, more than three times the power. Methamphetamine has more than three times the power of cocaine in creating addiction in the human mind and in those impacts that it has, as well as the brain damage that it causes. And so what does that mean to you and I? Well, it was early on that we discovered we'd have meetings that would last for 3 hours or longer. At the end of the meeting, we would adjourn the meeting, and the members would mostly, if not all, stay, because there was so much interest and so much enthusiasm. We were learning so much from each other, learning from the judges and from the attorneys and from the treatment specialists and from those themselves who'd experienced the addiction, and all beginning to realize that the impact was far, far greater than any of us knew, even though we all knew it was extremely severe. One district attorney said that a defense attorney, an attorney who practiced mostly family law, told him that he had, since the beginning of his practice, kept track of what caused divorces, and he'd become alarmed over recent years because methamphetamine had been the primary cause of his divorce cases in recent years. So the expanse of the drug goes far wider than you and I know. There are many states, California, Idaho, a number of states, not just in the West, that have taken very aggressive stands against methamphetamine, and there have been some consequences for that. There are, and I want to be sure and note that this is not a racial issue in any way, but currently the Mexican crime families, and there are about in any population 3 to 5% of every population are criminally inclined at any given point in time, and that a large number of those who are criminally inclined in the Mexican culture today are focused on the delivery of methamphetamine and those things that will allow people to manufacture methamphetamine. Approximately 85% of the methamphetamine that we discover in Oregon is delivered by Mexican nationals. And we know a little bit about Mexico's economy, a little bit about ours. Imagine if you were in business and you were very greedy and you could sell a product to someone who would likely give up their life, their own children, to have that product for 10 or 12 years. That's pretty high demand. Well, it is certainly extremely profitable. We have, in just a three-day period, one of our officers who has a drug-sniffing dog showed me his reports. He had 90-some thousand recovered in one, 20-some thousand recovered in another, well over 100 in 3 days. He'd recovered with one dog, one drug-sniffing dog, well over $100,000 in money from the dealers. That's one dog in 3 days. Oregon is not your average state. We know that we're number one in the United States of America, and you and I have an absolute responsibility to take action on that, because I guarantee you no one else will. No one else will if we don't each step forward and do something about it. There will be more than 7,000 children. There are today 7,000 children in foster care here. More than 70% of those 7,000 children are there because of methamphetamine, and that is probably less than a quarter, perhaps a tenth or so, of the total children that are in the emotionally and environmentally toxic environments of methamphetamine in our state this day. We discovered in the committee very early there is no cheap way, no easy way, no free way to overcome what I will call the monster methamphetamine. When we have states above us like Washington, whose legislature said, no, we are not going to give welfare benefits to convicted drug felons, and then we have, for a fact, convicted drug felons moving here to Oregon because our legislature, and I'm not judging you on that decision, just pointing it out, that our legislature has said, no, we will continue to supply federal welfare benefits to convicted drug addicts. Should that be changed? Well, we argued that at length, and a couple of questions came up. First of all, well, if that is changed, what will happen to the children who are at the same table with the convicted drug addicts? Won't they be the ones that don't eat? And so there are, it's a complex issue. I don't pretend it to be simple. But I will tell you that when you look at the pictures of the drug houses and you visit the drug houses, you rarely find food there, even if people are, in fact, in possession of the Oregon Trail Card, federal drug benefit capacity, because their first priority becomes the drug when they are addicted. It's the kids. Let us not mistake the fact that methamphetamine is not some crime problem. That's something the police should worry about. It's the kids. That's where the impact is the greatest. It's the families. And if your family hasn't been impacted, stand by, because I guarantee you in time, your family or extended family will see the impacts of methamphetamine, just as some of the families of your friends or neighbors have. If you will listen, you'll hear that from them. There is no easy way. If we are not aggressive, if we do not apply resources, if you and I do not take on the personal responsibility to learn and understand this drug well enough to educate those around us, to act responsibly to combat it, then Oregon will continue to be number one. It will continue to be a drug magnet. Let us not deceive ourselves. The addicts and the pushers who want to continue with the drug know that Oregon is an easy mark, that we are amongst the lowest per capita in funding of law enforcement, amongst the lowest in capita of funding of jail beds. They understand that, and just as you have done a marvelous job in dealing with violent crime, as our legislature in Measure 11 has dropped the violence, it's been a moral program, we have in fact done a very poor job, all of us, in dealing with methamphetamine. We will step up to the plate, or Oregon will, I promise you, continue to be a magnet for methamphetamine, and if it is, the consequences will be dire, and we have just seen the beginning. I apologize for going so long, and I'll turn the time to Anna Peterson. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members, for providing this opportunity this evening for testimony. I'm Anna Peterson. I'm the chair and founder of No Meth, Not in My Neighborhood, which is a Marion County area methamphetamine prevention coalition. We are all volunteers on that task force. I've also been privileged to be a member of the Governor's Meth Task Force since its beginning, and I serve on the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission. I'm here this evening to support the bills that are the result of the recommendations that came from the work of the Governor's Meth Task Force, and I wanted to bring along a visual, this notebook, which I can hardly carry anymore. It's getting so big and so thick. But I wanted you to see what I am going to be talking about. I wanted you to see the results of the work of the task force. In our meetings, this was only a visual way to show you. We came together as professionals, and some of us, like myself, as volunteers, from prevention, enforcement, and treatment backgrounds and organizations. At first, many of us were strangers to one another, and we were even suspect of one another because of our various backgrounds, and because in many cases, prevention, enforcement, treatment work alone. There hasn't been often a real collaboration between the three. In fact, sometimes it seems like we're having to make choices that pit one against another. So as we began to work together under the leadership and guidance of our chair, Chief Myers, we began to peel away that veneer of our outer identities, and we became receptive to the ideas and the beliefs of each other. Soon we were collaborating in our committees and our work teams, and together we were crafting a shared vision for meth reduction and a system for accountability and treatment and support for those who've become addicted to methamphetamine. We did not do this alone. We drew upon the testimony from experts in prevention, enforcement, and treatment, and many citizens who came to talk with us about how they were caring for children and families and how they were coping in their communities with the effects of methamphetamine. I want to stress that the task force believes in the acronym PET, Prevention, Enforcement, and Treatment. It's a three-legged stool, and all three legs of that stool must receive attention and support. We have received information and assistance in prevention by the Oregon Partnership, and we collaborated with the Oregon Partnership and the University of Oregon Journalism School to produce videos for public education and presentation on the dangers of methamphetamine. These will be shown in communities across the state and will be part of an anti-meth toolkit that will be produced as part of our prevention effort. Recommendations regarding enforcement were many, And I thought it was very interesting how we carefully debated and critiqued those recommendations. That was the entire task force, those from prevention and those from treatment, talking face-to-face, collaborating with law enforcement officers to come up with the best possible programs, the best possible changes in the law, the best possible actions along enforcement lines that would really begin to battle against methamphetamine. And we certainly considered recommendations around treatment. We focused on the drug court models, which have been so very successful in reducing recidivism and guiding meth users into productive meth-free life when they become contributing members of their communities. Now I'm going to stop talking about the meth task force, and I'm going to speak as a member of this community, as a volunteer from the community, and tell you what I've experienced and heard in my 2 years of work in this area. I've been out on the streets, and I've been in the businesses, and I've been in the homes throughout this community. And I've had an opportunity to watch, to talk with people, and to find out what they are looking for. And they are looking to you for leadership. They are looking to you for solutions to this incredible epidemic. The awareness about methamphetamine has grown exponentially in the last 2 years. And believe me, even if other people may not be here tonight to talk with you, they very much care what you are doing and how you are approaching the solutions for the problem of methamphetamine. I want to mention that I've walked through drug houses. I've watched police videos of drug houses after the arrests and after the children have been taken to safe care. I've seen the disorder and the filth that the chief was talking about. I've seen framed pictures. Excuse me. I've seen pictures of children hanging on walls. At one time, excuse me for being emotional. That just happens sometimes. But at one time, it was a family who cared enough about those children to have them in soccer programs, to be proud of what they were doing. Thank you. To place those pictures on the wall. But the day I was there, the wall was stained by pets and grime and filth from the disorderly living. And the children, of course, had been taken into custody. And everything had gone wrong in a house that at one time, obviously, had been running right. I saw the pornography. I saw the drug residue on the table, both in a room where children had been playing. That house isn't very far from here. We could walk there. But that house is also in every community across the state. I've been in businesses that are bearing the brunt of the thefts and of the loss of productivity when their own employees have become addicted to methamphetamine. They are facing larger and larger insurance bills, and they're facing more and more difficulties in trying to find employees who are drug-free. They are looking to you for answers and for help. Neighborhoods are losing value when drug houses are left to just left proliferating in the communities. And the property owners are dealing with tenants cooking meth and rendering the property uninhabitable. And those property owners are bearing the costs of the cleanup, which many times runs into thousands of dollars. In closing, I'll say that our local task force and many groups like ours across the state are looking to you for guidance, for answers, for your action and your support in the fight against methamphetamine. Thank you.
Thank you. Walt, would you address I guess I'd refer to it as the mindset of enforcement. And I came from that background, as does Representative Barker. At one time it was arrest them, throw them in jail, throw the key away. And I've come to believe that these new treatment programs and providing an opportunity for these people long-term is not only best for them but for society. It seems like I'm talking to the sheriffs and the chief of police, that is there a coming together to believe that those programs are very, very beneficial long-term rather than just incarceration?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I think that there are a couple of issues there. First of all, it is naive for us to assume that we are going to solve this problem without treatment. It is naive for us to believe that we, the state of Oregon, are going to advance against this terrible epidemic without doing more treatment. And one of the reasons I say that is we recognize that, depending on which statistics you look at, 7 to 15% of the people that go into treatment are successfully treated the first time. But we recognize, and largely from what it's clear, edified by what Craig showed us early on, if you repeat the treatment, it's a recurring disease, it's a recurring problem. If you stay on the horse until the race is done and you start implementing all the practices that Craig described earlier, then what happens is the treatment model changes, the effectiveness increases and improves. The other option to treatment is imprisonment. And even in the lowest cost jail, you're going to pay more than $25,000 per year for every inmate you've got, and then when they come out, the problem is not solved, and they'll go back to a life of crime. Here in Salem, and I think probably statewide, somewhere very close to 85% of our crimes are generated by methamphetamine. We need to do something to treat the addicts, and to give the drug courts, for example, have proven very effective. It's a model that works. We know it is. So we need to step up to the plate. We need to fund drug courts on a larger scale, and of course the capacity, and as Craig pointed out as well, there need to be an increase in jail beds so that some of those can get their feet underneath them and succeed through treatment outside the facility, you know, having started inside the facility. So it is definitely a three-legged stool, as Anna pointed out. Prevention is certainly the cheapest. If every child, right now we're finding, it's ironic, in the past, cocaine, heroin, two or three times as many males used and became addicted to cocaine and heroin as females. With methamphetamine, we're finding it to be 50%. Half those addicted and using methamphetamine are female. In some communities, it's even more. And there's some argument about how much that has to do with weight loss and all the pressures on single mothers for an increase in activity. And I don't know that. I believe we have not well defined what is causing that, but it is a reality that we recognize. And when we see that 8, 9, 10, 11-year-olds are becoming addicted to this drug throughout our state, and that the highest risk age group is 14 to 24, but we have here in Salem found a 77-year-old man who had just recently started using the drug, and it is across all class and cultural lines and across all different age groups because it is such an attractive drug. I mean, imagine if you just think about those numbers. It is, seven times better than the best meal you ever had in the experience, five times better than sex, three times better than cocaine, which was for decades the drug of kings. We have a problem here. It cripples the souls and hearts and minds of people. As Anna well described, a police officer came to me the other day and told me a very short story. I won't go into detail because it has not yet gone to court. But a scenario was being repeated in businesses and being televised by the security cameras where a small family would come in with small children. The children would create disruption, and as a result of that disruption, the father would commit criminal activities at great profit. And as I say, I can't go into the details, but at great profit. And eventually the detectives were able to track this down and go to the home. When they got to the home, they went inside. The patrol sergeant described it to me like this. He said when the door opened, it looked like a typical meth house. There was nothing there. It was a mess. But he said in the corner, they had the big screen TV and the $9,000, $10,000, $12,000 worth of electronic stuff, computer and all that. The bed was, of course, a mattress laying on the ground. He said the thing that got my attention the most was a 4-year-old child. It was midnight. The parents were in bed. It was a four-year-old child who was playing a video game. He described the video game to me like this. He said the way the game worked was the character in the video game, which the kid had learned, this four-year-old learned to play very well, would come up behind a police car, quickly open the door, yank the policeman out, strike the policeman on the head, pull his gun, shoot him, jump in his car, drive away, and then the pursuit began because of the police officers chased it. He said the thing that amazed him the most was when he asked the mother how she felt about that. She said, well, yeah, midnight probably is a little late for him to be playing the computer. I mean, think of what was going on in the mind of that four-year-old. Where will that four-year-old be? This is an intergenerational problem. It steals the hearts from parents. I have seen diaper rash, but I have raised six children in my home, but I have never seen the diaper rash that I've seen on the kids that come from the meth house. One of our officers had recently had a baby. I was leaving the garage late one evening, and I saw, I hadn't seen her since she had her baby. I asked her how she was doing, and she looked dismayed. I said, what's the matter, Melissa? She said, do you really want to know? I said, yeah. She said, come see these pictures. She took me over. She had just left the drug house. There was a 20-month-old baby there. And she said, I knew something was wrong with the baby because he kept dancing around on his feet. She said, 20 months old and incapable of saying even one word. In any event, she finally lifted him up and took his socks off. And he had open, pus-oozing sores on the bottoms of both of his feet. Can you imagine the pain and the suffering that that child went through, ignored by an addicted mother? That's one story of many. There are literally thousands of them in our state today. Thank you for your question, Mr. Chair.
Senator Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chief Myers, I wanted to go back to the question that you, well, to a question I had about a statement you made about Washington State taking the position that they are no longer going to provide welfare or Medicaid
right.
services to convicted drug offenders.
Right.
So tell me a little bit about that. I really need to know a little bit more. How is that defensible? How can they do that under the federal law? And is it just the offender themselves? And what about the family? What about the children?
Yeah.
Children like this?
It is a complicated issue. And I'm not recommending that you do that, just pointing out an example, and I'll explain. What happened was one of our members did a ride-along with police officers, and he came back to the following meeting, and he said, you know, I did a ride-along, and he said every single meth addict and pusher that they stopped had an Oregon Trail card in their pocket. That's what they used to get, you know, free food and free rent and those kinds of things. He said, it seems to me that we are, with our tax dollars, funding their habit of addiction. And, of course, as we know, once they become addicted, they quite often become disabled, and then they're left on the tax dole for the remainder of their lives because of the severe disability of addiction. So it was a great discussion about that. It was a debate, so we established a subcommittee. The subcommittee looked at it, and what they discovered was that, in fact, the federal government allows the legislature of each state to opt either way. Either yes, you do give those federal benefits to convicted drug felons, or no, you don't. And our concern was twofold. Number one, the children. The children still get the benefits. If there's a family of five, for example, the benefits are measured by individuals. So the other four family members that aren't convicted of drug felonies would still get the benefits. But the parent wouldn't. Of course, the question is the parent going to eat anyhow? And if anybody's going to go hungry, will it be the kids? And as I mentioned earlier, if you go into a drug house, you won't often find any food there. The kids are suffering. The kids need to be taken from the parents until the parents' problem is taken to a new level and is improved and their lifestyle is made more responsible. But that was one of the reasons that we wrestled with that. And then, of course, the other question was the question of, well, does that then put them in a situation of hopelessness? So I'm not advocating for that. The committee couldn't come to agreement, but my point was other states are being so aggressive about it, they're not tolerating the drug, and we are not. We are known as a drug-friendly state, and legalization of marijuana, medical marijuana, only one part of that. We are known in law enforcement circles as a drug-friendly state, and I guarantee you those people who run those crime families who own fishing fleets, who own trucking fleets, who own warehouses, and don't take my word for it, that's been testified to by the director of the DEA before Congress, three or four Congresses ago, it's common law enforcement knowledge, they have powerful resources, they are in many ways smart about doing their business, they know where the market is easier and where the marks are easier, and they have identified that in Oregon, and that's why we're number one.
Could I follow up, Mr.
Follow
Chair?
Up?
Thank you. Chief, I'm concerned about Washington State engaging that kind of activity because I kind of disagree with you. I think if we abandon these people, they're going to go out and steal to take care of their needs. So we're going to get it one way or the other. Our goal is to try to get people into drug court and treatment. And
yeah, I agree. I wasn't making the point that we should abandon them, only that there are things that others are doing that are pressuring the addicts and the pushers more and more toward Oregon.
I understand that. My concern is, and I don't know what other states are doing, but how many of the states surrounding Oregon have the same position as Washington State with regard to that issue, because if all the states around us start doing that, well, you know they're all going to come here because we still take care of them. So are you familiar with Idaho, Montana, Nevada, California, any state that's anywhere close to us?
No, I'm not. We have not analyzed all those. The reason that came to our attention about Washington was because of some people who were addicted who left Washington because they couldn't get those benefits and moved to Oregon.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Senator Wessett, did you have something?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Thank you. Chief Myers, as head of the task force, what will you recommend to interdict the importation of meth into Oregon? How will you stop this flow of methamphetamine and the precursors across the border, which I believe you characterized earlier in your testimony as 85% of the product that is being utilized in Oregon is being imported. How will you stop that?
Imported or created by Mexican nationals. Well, the pharmacy board and the governor have taken some pretty good steps, and the reason those steps were so important is because when they were cooking meth, if kids were removed from a place where meth was being cooked and tested within 2 hours, nearly 90% of those kids tested positive for methamphetamine. And I'm talking about toddlers and infants. I'm not talking about kids who are using the drug. So that's just one example. The impact on those kids and their brains was phenomenal when it was produced. Only about 20% of the drug was produced based upon those pharmaceuticals that were taken, the ephedrine, the pseudoephedrine that was taken from, stolen from, or purchased from pharmacies. The other 80% of the total mass comes from either Mexican nationals making it here, bringing the chemicals here, or delivering it here. There are a couple things that we know are effective, and the example I gave was one drug dog caught in less than a week's time. If the Oregon State Police were doing the kind of interdiction they could and would do if they were adequately staffed, we would seize huge amounts, as many other states are doing. That would have a chilling effect. That would not stop the problem. That would have a chilling effect. By the way, when they were cooking it here, and of course when they still do cook with the imported ephedrine and pseudoephedrine, for every pound of methamphetamine they create, between 6 and 7 pounds of toxic waste are left behind right here in Oregon, not just in the homes and on the rental properties that cause thousands to repair, but also in the environment and in the rivers and streams. They just dump it wherever. So in my view, you need to increase your enforcement. You would need to increase your capacity of your jails and, of course, your prosecution. And you would also need to really make sure that treatment was done in a responsible way. And I recognize the costs of all those things are very high. And we went into the task force knowing that there was not some money tree out there with unlimited funds. And that's why we point, first of all, as I mentioned earlier, that each of us needs to take the personal responsibility to become well-educated enough about the drug and to ensure that those around us are, because my belief is, and in fact it's been proven, that children well-educated on the dangers of drug abuse by responsible, caring adults make good choices the vast majority of the time. So that's the cheapest way to fix it. But it requires all of those things will have to be put into order. Tighter laws as well.
Thank you.
Chief, what would your recommendation be? You keep talking about the Mexican nationals, so I'm assuming most of those people are the illegal aliens that are here.
A high percentage.
Okay. When they are arrested, should the state of Oregon be spent taking valuable treatment bed space for them, or should we be primarily concentrating on locking them up and trying to treat our own citizens?
I should probably let other experts speak to this, but my belief and understanding is that the deliverers of the drug, the producers and the manufacturers of the drug, though the Mexican nationals, are generally not engaged in addiction and use of the drug as much as the delivery and the production. But I defer that.
Is that accurate?
Okay.
Senator Winsett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One further question. How important do you believe that the creation of appropriate civil forfeiture laws would be in helping to interdict these flow of drugs into Oregon?
Extremely important. Our drug teams throughout this state were much better funded when we had adequate and reasonable forfeiture laws. When we tightened the limits on those laws to the point that they were no longer functional and productive, then that revenue flowed to other places, not to government that pays, that foots the bill for all the damage of the drugs. The revenue flowed to other places, and the revenue was cut off, and the drug teams were dissipated. The state police are here, and they could give you more specifics, but the loss to law enforcement was phenomenal when the seizure laws were changed.
Anything further? Yeah. Representative Pearson?
Chief Myers, the proposals that have been laid out here and that we're considering in our joint committee are make a policy choice to relatively emphasize enforcement activity directed at local manufacture in local labs as opposed to crackdown on importation and dealing. And I'm wondering what your view is about that policy choice. That is, to the elevation of sentences, for example, is focused to not exclusively but more at manufacture and also dealing in very large quantities than it is in dealing in smaller quantities. And I wonder if you have a view about that policy choice.
I do. With what the governor and the pharmacy board have done with ephedrine and pseudoephedrine, I am confident that the number of people that will be cooking, and I'll turn to our experts to correct me if I'm wrong, will more likely be those who are cooking more professionally from larger quantities and more engaged with the production train from the high profit making, such as the Klein families out of Mexico. They will be doing more and more of the producing. And already, as I mentioned, they've done 80%. The ephedrine and the pseudoephedrine is a multi-billion dollar business. Germany, India, China, they have factories that produce ephedrine and pseudoephedrine. It is a multi-billion dollar business. And the pharmaceutical companies, and there are people who will spend great amounts of money in lobbying, and I'm sure many of you read the article in the Oregonian. If you didn't, I would commend it to you. The Oregonian did an outstanding job uncovering methamphetamine and talking about what happened in Congress, how lobby power came forth and basically said, well, law enforcement's just overreacting to this problem. Well, hang on, friends and neighbors, because it's in Boston now. We'll have a whole different story coming out of Congress, the next Congress, because they're going to be as alarmed as we are, because it is such a tasty drug that the addicts there will give up their heroin and their cocaine, and they'll jump on the methamphetamine wagon as well. But until Congress gets on the wagon and does something more aggressively to control this, it's a huge industry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Gerard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What's the cost on the street to people who are addicted, or is that someone else going to speak to that?
70 for 16th of an ounce, 140 for an eighth of an ounce.
Thank you.
And one dose is an eighth of an ounce, right?
16.
You went over this 1/16.
1/16.
Well,
how many doses would they get out of an eighth?
A quarter of a gram would be a dose.
So it's.
Ready? Anything further?
Thank you for your patience.
Thank you.
Thank you. Well, with all the talk about treatment, this is a good segue for Judge Daryl Larson from Lane County, who's our next witness here, to talk to us about drug courses.
Madam Chair and Senators and Representatives of this Honorable Committee, I'd be very pleased to talk to you about that. I'm also a member of the Governor's Task Force on Methamphetamine, and I think some of the members of that have done a good job in referencing the things they've talked about tonight, and I may touch upon some of the things that they've already mentioned, particularly Craig Campbell's. But I think if I was to begin, I'd probably begin with a quotation from some researchers by the name of Marlo DiMatteo and Fetzinger in 2003, who said the following: "We know that drug courts outperform virtually all other strategies that have been attempted for drug-involved offenders." I started my legal career in 71 in the prosecutor's office in Lane County, worked there for about 18 plus years, have been a judge since the beginning of 1990, and I would say that statement is absolutely, in my experience, to be true. I think the best way I can handle this in terms of having you understand the system we call drug court, which is just a methodology, really, of processing people through the criminal justice system, is to try to compare for you the realities, the practical realities of the traditional business as usual system versus the drug court system, and taking a look at how this affects a drug offender coming through the system. In the traditional system under sentencing guidelines, basically we've got this grid and there's a big black line across it, and everybody below it's going to stay in the community. They're basically going to be on probation with some sort of conditions and maybe some jail time that in many of our counties is really fairly meaningless because there really isn't that much jail space, so they oftentimes don't do any significant portion of that jail time. The person is placed on, in the drug case, ordinary drug case, 18 months of formal so-called supervised probation. What that means, in fact, that it takes days, usually, to get the probation officer together with the offender to sit them down and explain to them what their obligations are going to be. Many of these cases are then done, something is done with them called case banking, which is essentially that they enter the person into the computer system and they basically want the computer system to supervise this person on their probation. They may or may not be told to go to treatment. Even if they are told to go to treatment, in Oregon right now, there really isn't very much treatment available. So assuming the person is told to go to treatment and somebody, and they are motivated personally to do it and can find the money to do it, which are some pretty big ifs, then they may start going to some treatment. The supervision is essentially one written report per month that's expected by the end of the month or some set time period in the particular supervision case. That report may or may not come in, and I can certainly say that from my experience with the regular traditional parole and probation system, most of these people are not going to be going to treatment. Oftentimes, even the ones who are motivated to go to some treatment are motivated to go to the treatment that will keep the probation officer off their back and the treatment provider off their back by constantly showing up just enough at treatment to have the treatment counselor not send a violation report to the probation officer. The probation officer, oftentimes, because the paper flow system is not very good or coordinated in any fashion, will very likely not get reports very quickly, if at all, from the treatment provider. Once there is a report finally from the treatment provider that the person is not complying, it's going to take days or weeks for any paper to be generated to process a potential violation of this person's case. It'll take days or weeks for the prosecutor's office to act on it, if they act on it at all. In our county, the prosecutor's office basically said, we've got so few prosecutors, we're not going to even prosecute a lot of these cases for probation violation. So essentially, that's at the point where if you put somebody on probation, nothing's going to happen to them. And you're not going to get them to go to treatment either. It's really fairly impossible in a meaningful sense for probation officers to meaningfully supervise drug offenders who are coming through the system unless they're there for a huge backlog of prior record to the point where they are raised high enough on the point scale of most probation officers' caseload for them to really pay some particular close attention to the offender. This is not a knock on probation officers. There are too many offenders and there are too few probation officers. They have too much work to do. They have to focus on the most severe of their caseload. Contrast this with the drug court system. The offender has to choose, in most drug courts, to enter the drug court program in some sort of voluntary fashion. It may quickly become involuntary once they enter, but they have to enter voluntarily. At that point, the judge tells the person, you're going to your treatment orientation today, and the person who is there from treatment is in court with them, along with the public defender and sometimes or sometimes not the district attorney. And from that point on, this person is being supervised every day by both the treatment person and by the court. And there is a one-to-one relationship between treatment and the court. The court knows what's going on with this person virtually every day. And that takes a system to be built up that we refer to as drug courts. If the person doesn't show up or quickly falls off the chart, what's going to happen in most drug courts is the judge is going to tell the public defender or whoever the person's lawyer is, I want you to go out there and find this person and get them back here. They may also order a bench warrant, but in my experience in our court, most of the time, the public defender actually lassoes this person and gets them back to court quickly. That is a tremendous cost savings to the entire system in terms of the bench warrant process, the arrest, the booking, and all the rest of that occurs. So most of ours are done in voluntary appearances, even when there's a warrant out. What about the treatment? Well, the treatment is usually at least intensive outpatient treatment, which is three times a week for about 3 hours per day. In most courts, they require support groups of two or more times per week, depending on the nature of the person's addiction problems. There are one-to-ones with their counselor, oftentimes one time a week, and they also have to be in regular court appearances, and that depends on which court and which drug court they're in. In Marion County, there aren't as many people in drug court, so they see them very often. In my court, I can't really do it much more than once a month unless I need to see them more often, in which case I select which person I will see more often, and I will see them every day if I have to, but I have a caseload that's significant enough that I can't do that with everyone. These regular court appearances are positive or negative depending on whether or not the person's complying. You are using both negative sanctions to get them to comply and positive reinforcement to get them to comply. And quite frankly, if you think about it from a human perspective, sometimes a person who is a drug offender really hasn't had a lot of success in their life. And they may, for the first time, be starting to do some of their treatment, but maybe not all of the things you want them to do. But at least it's a start. When that person comes back to court, it's much more effective for me to pump that person up and congratulate them on what they are starting to do to overcome their addiction than to say one day in jail right now because you didn't go to all your treatment. The power of the court is substantial in these programs if it's exercised in a frugal way, both from the point of view of the taxpayer and the resources available in the community. Drug courts also, as a part of their process, require the person to participate in what I will call wraparound services, educational programs, maybe literacy, pushing them to get a job and to get one quickly, to become more productive, to go out and do community service work, even if it's not a part of the order, to do something that's productive. And the treatment provider is able to work directly with the court on a personal basis and a constant basis to get these people to do this. The bottom line is that it's harder for the offender by far in a drug court program than it is on supervised probation. And the bottom line of that is that it actually does get results. Craig Campbell was talking about Dr. Rosen's studies down at UCLA, and I think if I could have a joinder of our talks here with respect to that, is that the drug court model is really designed to not only demonstrate why these people are problematic from what Craig says, but why the drug court model works. One of the things that happens to the brains of methamphetamine addicts is that they can't remember anything for very long. And the more they use it, the worse that gets. And so if you're going to do treatment successfully, and that really is going to be the only cost-effective thing that the public can do, is to get them to comply with treatment and set up a system where they actually do it, is to constantly supervise them and for a long time until their brain is able to slowly repair itself and at the same time try to educate them about treatment protocols, get them motivated to see some reason why they would want to do this, which most offenders on regular probation, if you're a methamphetamine addict, how are you going to develop the wherewithal mentally in your own head to want to do treatment? I mean, the first thing and the primary thing I focus on with every offender that comes into the drug court program in Lane County is, I don't care what all these other people are saying to you or what you think about your situation, what I want you to do, and the only thing I'm going to expect is that you do what they tell you to do, but the one thing I want you to do for sure is figure out a reason why it's important enough for you to do this. And his reason, your attorney's reason, or my reason isn't good enough for you. It's got to be your reason. And you know, it may take a little while, but most people begin to figure out some reasons why they actually want to do this, how they might actually benefit by it. And that's like a hook catching a fish. Once you've got the hook in the fish, you can actually pull them in a high percentage of the time. And that's why drug courts work. the drug court model is not new. I think a lot of people maybe have this concept that drug courts are some sort of newfangled model. They've been around since 1989. The second drug court in the entire country was in Portland. The 13th drug court in the entire country was in Eugene. And we've now got drug courts all over the state, and we've had them for long enough that there are a number of judges out there in many of your counties who you could call up or have your staff call up and say, explain this process to me or answer a question here. You'll get ready answers from your jurisdiction about why this is something you ought to care about in your community. How did drug courts start? They start primarily because judges are sick and tired of being sick and tired. Judges are actually going out and finding out something about this thing called drug court because they're tired of not getting an effect from what they're doing. And they start drug courts and they take the time and effort to put the process together in your particular counties because they know they work. They've got people that they trust who've done it, and they once they see how it's done, they begin to understand why it actually works. And it works because of the constant supervision and never, ever taking no for an answer. And with drug addiction, that's got to be the name of the game. One of the persons said here, in maybe different terminology, that addiction is a chronic relapsing disease. Addiction is a chronic relapsing disease. I can't guarantee you that everybody that goes to a drug court who successfully graduates is not going to relapse. A significant proportion of them over time probably will. The question is, how deep will that relapse be, and how quickly do they use the tools we gave them in drug court to get off that and back into a sober life? And the answer is, research has shown us that's pretty darn successful. With respect to statistics, in a two-year period following graduation or termination, offenders in Oregon who participated in drug court, and this was in Multnomah County, had 58 fewer arrests for property crimes, 75% fewer arrests for persons crimes, and 80% fewer probation parole violations. Nancy Miller in the back from OJD was just telling me that we've been keeping statistics now on a statewide database for some time on drug offenders and drug courts in particular, and our statistics are starting to show that over 90% of 1,000 offenders have no new arrests in a year who've come out of the drug court programs. Drug courts are good not only for the people who graduate from drug courts, but the research shows that even participants who participated in a drug court process for some period of time, even if they don't graduate, end up reaping huge benefits that are beneficial to the public and to them personally because they don't reoffend at the high rates that they would have offended at before, and we get better results from their family and personal functioning, the whole gamut of expenses to the public. I said that drug courts are not new. They are now in existence in all 50 states, a number of the territories, and in a number of foreign countries. Essentially, they've grown because it works. What about the cost-benefit analysis? It's ironic that the absolute best, most cutting-edge research in the entire country that's ever been done on drug court cost-benefit analysis or economic analysis was done right here in the state of Oregon and is continuing to this day. They've also added a number of California jurisdictions to this same research. It seems to me from where I live and what I think about being a taxpayer and a voter is that there's a lot of human cry about trying to get government to work a little more like a business, to be more productive, to get better results, and do it for less money. Ladies and gentlemen, that is exactly what drug courts do. Why do we even have a criminal justice process in this state or any other state? And I would suggest to you the answer is very simple. It's to try to get improved public safety. Are we getting it from the traditional system? Absolutely not. If we were, all these judges that have gone out and taken the trouble to start drug courts wouldn't have done it. We are not getting bang for the buck, and all the research shows us that. And now the research, when you stand the traditional system right next to the drug court system in a single jurisdiction, we are proving that it's dramatically better to do it in the drug court model. The Multnomah County statistics on this, which were fairly recent, I think they were released in 2003, Multnomah County drug court cost $1,441 less per participant than the business-as-usual processing methodology. The total cost and investment savings to the taxpayer over a 30-month period, and this includes victimization costs, averaged over $5,000 per person who went through drug court. Ladies and gentlemen, I think that I can say this without anybody being able to prove different. There is no other criminal justice process we know of in the state of Oregon that gives that kind of result. And I am very, very happy that 10 years of my haranguing people in this building about drug courts and why we ought to do them may finally begin to pay off. Because I haven't been doing it because I was a drug court judge. I've been doing it because I'm a taxpayer and I'm a citizen whose car gets broken into just like everybody else's. I actually happen to be a judge also. But that is an also. Drug courts are going to give us what we want, improve public safety, and they'll do it for less of my tax dollar and your tax dollar. And I think the people who voted for you will very much appreciate that. And actually, the kids of these people who are going through our drug programs will appreciate it as well. I do want to mention just a couple other points, and these are sort of tangential, but sort of related to what I'm saying. There is a methodology that's been laid out in the legislation, and I take issue with some of that, but a lot of it can be worked out, I think, behind the scenes in terms of making it work better. And one of the things I want to make sure you understand is that the Judicial Department have certain employees that are employed in the drug courts, because it really is a court process, called coordinators, and they are OJD employees. There are four courts in the state of Oregon who, because of federal grant funding, and that's the way they've been getting their money to do their drug courts, are about to expire. And I think that that's in Malheur, Marion, Benton, and in the Multnomah County DUII drug court that looks at multiple-time DUII offenders or drunk drivers. It is crucial that the money be in this budget, in however you do this, to make sure that those coordinators are funded. We don't want to be losing drug courts at the very time we're trying to add drug courts, and those courts have proven themselves to do a good job and to know how to do their business. It'd be a shame if they had to close down and then start all over again. There's a lot of startup costs, obviously, in that. Other counties, to be able to do a drug court, and this is my real point, really have to have a coordinator to do that. And I would strongly suggest to you that it makes a lot of sense business-wise to keep those coordinators as OJD employees, because after all, this is primarily a court process. It is a processing methodology within the court. And why do we need coordinators? Well, there are a number of reasons that are very easy to understand. First of all, they manage the rapid paper flow that has to occur in a drug court for the judge to know what's going on with all these offenders that are coming before them, all of whom, if you really understand the dynamics of a drug offender, are that the drug offender is going this way to everybody, and they were doing that to their counselor as well. And so to keep the judge on target with the treatment provider hand in hand is extremely important to get results, and the coordinators help do that. They also develop the systems within a particular community that are unique to that community to get the most bang for the buck from all the resources that are available in that community. The judge hasn't got time to do that. I'm in court all day. I didn't prepare these remarks today because I was in court all day. I did it sitting in the back of the room in the last half hour. The coordinators also keep the judge constantly informed just about the business of the drug court as well as the offenders. And they also are really important in managing the financial aspects of the drug court, to put the financial systems together to make it work and to make it work in the particular county and circumstances of that particular county. I want to also remind you that there is an association of drug court professionals in virtually every state in the country and in this state as well, and it's an organization that's been around for quite a few years now. A lot of people are members of that and past members of that. They are a resource for you to tap anytime you want. You can contact me or OJD, and Nancy Miller or Tim Travis over there can really point you in the direction you need to go. You can get it on the internet and find out a lot about what's going on with drug courts in the team room from the OJD website. I would urge you to feel free to call me or any of these OJD professionals or drug court professionals to get answers to your questions. If I can answer any questions.
Thank you very much, Judge Larson. I've actually sat through a drug court session in Marion County, and it's truly amazing what you see going on before your very eyes just in the weekly sessions. And they do have the luxury of doing them weekly in Marion County, so I really appreciate your efforts. And you can rest assured that That was the one. That was probably the first area that the work group reached consensus on, is the value of drug courts in addressing this.
You got through to us.
Yeah.
No drug
Walker.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to recognize Judge Larson for his tremendous work in this area. I've been to one of their graduations at in his courtroom in Lane County, and they're tremendous to watch. These people are so excited and so proud of where they've been and come from and what they've achieved. I mean, that it's just incredible for the families. So I agree with you. When we were in Multnomah County in January for a Judiciary Committee hearing, we heard about a program they're doing now called mental health courts that are patterned after the drug courts. And I was quite fascinated by that and actually want to go up and take a look and see what they're doing.
But you can do it in your own home. I'm a mental health court judge, and I run two mental health court programs that are sort of like drug court.
Oh, so I don't have to go to Multnomah County. I'll just come see you.
Come on down.
It's actually Clackamas County, Senator Walker.
Oh, okay. Well, the trouble is I'm just never home these days, but when I get back, when they release me from this building, I'll come see you about that because I think they're pretty interesting.
I'll try not to ask you if you're at the end of my docket, if you're still taking your medication.
All right. I'll be sure and slip you that note. But, Madam Chair, I'm glad that you all realize, too, that these are great ways to use our tax dollars and to get people rehabilitated and back into society and being productive citizens. So thanks, Judge.
I want to add one thing, too. The chief talked about this Washington law. My understanding is that actually Washington just recently changed that law because it was costing them too darn much money to do it the other way. And so
okay.
I think before we jump to conclusion, sometimes I know this has happened to me, is that my information is from a case that happened, you know, a while ago. Well, it turns out that that isn't right by the time we finally start talking about it. So I think I would... It's a very complicated issue, the one that was brought up, and I think it's one that we looked at a lot as a meth task force, and there were a lot of good ideas on both sides about that, and it's a weighing process, but I would urge you to exercise some degree of caution in really taking that one on.
Thank you. Representative Flores.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Judge Larson, as you were talking about some of the protocols that you use in drug court with the offenders and their involvement, you mentioned that they're encouraged to get a job and or do community work. Did I understand you correctly?
Correct.
And then are there impediments to an offender getting a job at a point in time, especially if an employer is requiring drug testing, and how do you manage that?
Actually, you know, Lane County is a county where it has a lot of motorhome manufacturers, and so a lot of people that I see in drug court are actually working out there, Country Coach or Marathon or any of those other big operations, and they drug test a lot too, but they like our program and they like the people. This was a long process of getting them to like this, but they realize that if they're in our program, they can be much more assured that they're not going to be testing positive for drugs, because we're testing them all the time too, and we're holding them accountable. We really want people to be productive, and every issue that this particular person has is one that we feel incumbent in our drug court, and really most drug courts, to address those issues, because we want the whole person treated, not just one thing. Oftentimes, I think in governmental programs, we target one particular thing, thinking that's the magic bullet. That's not the magic bullet. The whole person is the problem, and we've got to address the whole problem, and so that's what we try to do.
Quick follow-up, Madam Chair,
please.
Thank you. So then are you proactive about communicating or messaging with employers in your area about the process that you're working in and trying to accomplish successfully? Is that part of the
It's
effort?
A little bit touchy, as you can well imagine, because a particular person in drug court isn't going to want us to call their employer and say this person's, you know, being prosecuted for a felony drug offense. But what usually happens is that because they're having to come to court regularly, you know, they've got to explain why they're wanting this time off for an hour in the morning to go somewhere, and most of them have to tell their supervisors that they're involved in a drug court program. And that used to be somewhat of a problem. It isn't a problem anymore because they know we get good results and they like the employees that are participating in that program gives them an added degree of assurance. And there's a high percentage of use of drugs by people working in that industry as well.
Thank you. Other questions? Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Ms. Larson, and thank you for coming tonight. Senator Carter, did you want to participate, or are you an observer? Observer. Okay. Now, for the moment that we've been waiting for, the drum roll. The best name in the whole meth issue, Thugs Off Drugs. And I don't want to imply that there's some connection, but this you are from Representative Krieger's hometown.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Alan Evans, and I am the founder and director of a unique program that we run in Clatsop County called Thugs Off Drugs, and we're a rehabilitation and a prevention program. I myself was a methamphetamine addict for 27 years. I've been clean and sober about 3 years. And I was a homeless, indigent drug addict, a person who did not know how to live his life without drugs, couldn't hold a steady job. And one of the big issues that I found was, where can a person walk in the door and say that I'm broke, I'm homeless, and I'm a drug addict, can you help me? And what do we provide in the state for that? So what I'm going to do is a little presentation on PowerPoint. It's going to have a little history about where I come from and what we do today.
This is K2 News, the spirit of the Northwest.
Meth turns people into monsters with no regard for themselves or others.
Tonight in a Team 2 report, K2's Anna Song looks at efforts to solve Oregon's meth epidemic, one addict at a time. Anna?
Steve Nadley, hardly a day goes by now without some kind of meth bust making headlines. Some would say we have lost the war on drugs. But in the midst of this losing battle, a local man is trying to save people from meth. He began by getting saved himself.
Seaside is a place where people go to relax, take a stroll on the beach, or even brave the chilly waves. But just down the highway from all of this tranquility is a world you don't see, a darker world of addiction.
We are supposedly, per capita, the largest user of meth in the state of Oregon.
It's why Seaside now has this sign greeting you right on the highway when you come into town.
So now we're the first meth wash community. It's all because of the Thugs Off Drugs.
Well, yeah.
That's where Alan Evans comes in.
I used drugs for the first time at 9 years old.
By 13, Alan was addicted to meth.
My addiction was completely out of hand.
It was in Seaside 2 years ago that Alan hit rock bottom.
I sat with a gun in my mouth, with a telephone in my hand, and realized that I had no one to call.
Alan's final brush with the law was here at the Safeway in Seaside. He passed a fake check he'd made on his own computer. You see, Alan was trying to get arrested. It worked.
This officer came in and he sat down and he was hurting bad. He was strung out, didn't know what to do with himself. He says, "You're not a bad person." He says, "You're just a sick person. Just think about your life. That's all I'm asking you to do at this time." And he did. I mean, he used to drink or drug since, and that was 2 years ago, New Year's Eve.
Since then, Alan has founded Thugs Off Drugs. He is very proud of the name and proud of what it stands for.
What better job for me to have than to teach somebody to change their life, as I've changed my life.
Alan started the program with some money he'd saved up and public money he sought from the city council.
Here was this man that really didn't know how to present this stuff.
But the council took a gamble on Alan and gave him $1,000 of seed money. He turned around and rented this building right on the highway. Within 30 days, it filled up with addicts.
Yeah.
Just like Alan.
We get 2 to 3 new people every single day. We have a population of 6,000 here. We've had 230 people come through our organization in 6 months.
People like C. Harris. C. is 32 years old, 8 months pregnant, and a very recently recovering meth addict.
I've got 2 weeks under my belt.
I asked C how that's possible, how she could still do meth, knowing a human life is growing inside of her. She doesn't know.
Meth would be underneath.
She shows me the injection points where she would shoot the drug into her veins.
All scars from meth. Two years ago, I never had any of this.
And then there is her face. C used to care about what she looked like.
The fact that I'm putting this chemical that is so hideous and so insidious into my body that is literally eating my skin.
I carry him with me.
Which brings us back to Sergeant Mark Whistler. He keeps a reminder in his pocket, too.
These are the coins that Alan Evans has received. And he's given me three of them so far. The first one was a 30-day sobriety coin. This is a one-year coin. And I would actually say a little prayer in remembrance of him and the work that he's doing. I get to see miracles every day.
The miracle of changing lives that began with the changing of one.
Everybody here, like myself, just wanted an opportunity to be somebody. We just never knew how. We never truly knew how to do it.
Since we shot this story, C. Harris has given birth to a baby girl. Her name is Penelope Willow, and she is miraculously healthy. But tonight, C. is back in the hospital facing the reality of what her drug abuse has done to her body. For the second part of this story, Living with the Scars, join us tomorrow night at 11. And if you want more information about this recovery program, Thugs Off Drugs, you can head to our website.
And C. Harris is, by the way, she's doing great, and the baby's doing great. And she's got six months, the 30th of this month. And what we did was we opened this little organization, this club, to find out if there was more people like myself that was out there. If there was more people that didn't know how to get help and where to get help. And if there was more indigent drug addicts on the street that had the same problem as I had. And when we opened the door, we were amazed to have 91 people in 30 days walk through our door. So we got some people in the community together, which are city council people, sheriffs, and we created a board of directors. And we started an idea. And our mission statement is that we're a community effort to deal with crime, and we accomplish this by reaching out to the active addicts in our community and providing them with some resources that we do not provide in the state of Oregon. So, and now, if you have a drug problem, you're homeless, and you have no money, you can walk into our door, and we're going to provide you with some help. And without that help, this is what happens here. And Maxine Bernstein actually printed this on the front page of the Oregonian in December. And these are all drug crimes, and these are people that have no money. I'm not saying that they're all, you know, doing the right thing. But so what we've done is, and this was it for me. I got arrested. Actually, I got rescued when I got arrested because I had no way to get help. So jail was adequate for me. A bed and three meals was going to work fine if I got arrested. So what we've done is, we opened the club, and that's working great. This is our men's intake house. This house holds 15 men, and this house holds 15 women. And these are all indigent drug addicts, 30 people. We've had a waiting list since we've opened our door. Through both of the houses, we get people jobs. We help them get food stamps. We help them get on their feet, and we help them with structured living. We hold random urinalysis every single week. They have to go to a meeting a day, work with our mentorship program, and then once they get a little bit of money saved up and they've got their job and it's going good, that's our recovery center. We move them to stage two. This is our stage two men's house. It has eight men in it. This is our first women with children's house to work with Department of Human Service, women with children bound by addiction. This is our second one. We just opened this one last week. This is our reunited families house. And this is the reunited families house. And I'd like to, I'm just going to slip through all that and not even get into that. Today we have 67 people in seven houses. We house more people in our county than our county jail does for what it costs to feed our county jail. It takes $12 a day for people to live in this program. And we still have a waiting list today. We've had 270 people in the last 11 months come through our program, and over 70% of them are still successful today. So we also run our Meth Watch program for the city of Seaside, which city of Seaside is the first Meth Watch community in the state of Oregon. Our crime rate's lowered because right now I've got 65 people in-house that would be breaking the law if they weren't in our houses today. And so it lowers our crime rate. It helps with our foster care system because mothers got an opportunity to change their life. And we work with our children, educate people in our community on drug abuse, and that's about it. You guys all got some of the stuff we do. We write a newspaper also. And we're trying to make Clatsop County the safest we could possibly make it. And I'll tell you, since we opened our doors and they ran this little piece on the news about us, we've had every single county in the state of Oregon calling us to try to get people in our program in Clatsop County. In the whole state of Oregon, it's been extremely difficult to do so. But it's an affordable program that any community can put together, and thank you for your time.
We have about 16 that were not invited testimony to be a public testimony. Bob Ovette, can you come back tomorrow? We're gonna hold you off tomorrow to make sure we have time to get as many as we can tonight. Carly King, Linda Tolan, and Susan Don. Is it Donnie or Donnie?
Donnie.
Can you come up, please? Three of you. We're gonna have to manage our time. We've got an hour. If you kind of keep it to about, under five, four or five, if you can, kind of summarize if you have to.
Okay. I'm going to go ahead and start. My name's Carly King, and I'm a member of the Recovery Association Project. I'm also a graduate of Marion County Drug Court. Excuse me. I graduated Marion County Drug Court February 11th of this year.
Good.
Thank you. I was a meth user. I'm a meth addict. I'm a recovering meth addict. I use from the age of 12 to the age of 22. I'm now 24. I have three children. Two of those children are not with me right now. They're with my mom. During my addiction, like someone else had said earlier this evening, it took away my heart for my family. And I like to say that I was a good mother, but no, I was not there emotionally for my children, and I abandoned them. December 5th of 2003, I had my youngest taken away from me. My other two were already in with my family members. And for whatever reason may be, that opened up my eyes. I was already in drug court, but I was not staying clean. Having my son taken from me, not being allowed to see him, was a very hard thing. And through the support of drug court, I was able to instantly get into treatment. I was able to go to drug court and tell the judge I cannot stay clean and I'm scared. And that judge made room for me in the jail and put me in jail. And they had mentors, people that they were working, the drug court team, got me out of jail that same night and got me into treatment. I went through inpatient treatment. I was able to get my son back within 30 days. I don't know what the rates are. I don't know what statistics show that, you know, how long people's children are taken away from them and how long before they get them back. I was able to get him back in 30 days and continue with inpatient treatment for 3 months with him, working with DHS, working with drug court, working with treatment, working with everybody. My case closed for DHS last summer of July. All I know is that drug court's done a lot for me. I'm working. I pay tax. I'm 24, and I've worked many times. This is the first year that I ever paid taxes. That's a big thing for me. I didn't know how to do it, but I got help. I'm able to provide for my children. I'm looking at getting my other two back this summer. I'm productive in this community now. I can go to work and not have to worry about who's watching me. So I can steal from my cash register. That's a good feeling today. The thing that breaks my heart when I was in towards the end of drug court was, as someone had said, the funding's running out. And people were turned away because they couldn't afford it out of their own pocket. And that broke my heart, because I was given a chance, and I did pay out of my pocket somewhat, but I did have help too, and I just felt like there's no way that they were ever going to be successful as I am, because drug court is what I needed, and I feel that other people need. If they don't have drug court, they're just going to continue in the cycle of going to jail and going back out and going back to jail and going back out and losing their family and losing themselves. That's all I have to say.
My name is Linda Tolan. I am a recovering addict from meth. I'm with the Recovery Association Project. I discovered methamphetamines at the age of 29, 1989, here in Salem. I found out I was pregnant by 1990 with my first child. She was born clean and sober thanks to being in treatment here at Marin County. But again, I relapsed after she was born. Continued to use until 1995 when she was 4 years old, almost 4 years old. And I had the chance, Children's Services got involved, took her away from me, and I had a chance to go to inpatient treatment with my child. That was the best 6 months spent in my life for my children. At that time, they had what they called therapy play for the children. I did not realize that my daughter, that was 3 years old, knew the ingredients to make methamphetamines. During play therapy, she'd be sitting, waiting for a reaction. I never thought that. I didn't think she was picking up this stuff from my behaviors. Thanks for her being able to do treatment along with me and her getting the services she needed at that time. Today, she's a 13-year-old straight-A student involved in any sport that is available to get in school. She's a remarkable child. But at the age of, she was about 7 when I relapsed again. But through the treatment, she was able to still be a normal little girl. I went to prison at that time and did 5 years in prison. Did treatment in prison, got a lot of tools and in focus program for women. I did not finish treatment. I did not graduate. I got kicked out, went to segregation. I was paroled from segregation, and I thought when I paroled that I'd be out using the next day. I wasn't. I got into Straight Facts. And thanks to Straight Facts for an intensified program, today I have almost 2 years out of prison, and I have not used and have not committed a crime, and I am part of my children's life again. So I am grateful for the access to treatment, and it does work.
My name is Susan Doney. I am a leader for the RAP Recovery Association Project. I do have a learning disability. When I was 35, I found out that I was pregnant. My son was born on September 29th. I was using meth very heavily before I found out I was pregnant with him. He died of SIDS on January 16th, and today I am still clean and sober through it all. And I couldn't do it without drug court and treatment. Thank you.
Thank you.
Carlin Todd, Bill Tolan, and Jay Cups. We had trouble reading your first name, so I thought the last name would be helpful.
My name is Harlan Todd, and I'm a recovering meth addict. I've been in drugs with meth for about 30 years, from age 9 to 39. It took a while for me to learn that meth was doing to my body, to my mind, and to my family. I've lost all my family members. But this last, I've also been incarcerated for the last 20 years, 17 years. And I started a program in Pendleton called Step to Freedom. When I got out, I got into another program because it's part of the reason why I was released from prison early is because I completed a program. I completed one program here in Marin County, and I relapsed from 96 to 2001. I was clean. I relapsed in 2001. I was charged with PCS2, which is possession of controlled substance. Was given 60 days in jail. Now I started into Straight Facts. I'm still in Straight Facts, but it's helped me out a lot. And hearing some of the statistics that the people were talking about, memory loss, teeth, I lost my teeth. The program does work. I've been clean since January 28th, 2002. And I'm starting to get back with some of my family members, slowly but surely, but need help. I'm paying out of my pocket. I have no medical to help pay mine. I'm paying straight out of my pocket. It took me 4 years after I was released from prison to get a job, that somebody would trust me. Then I lost the job, not because of drugs, it's because of living situations. Now I got a good job, and getting in with the Recovering Association Project, it's helped me out to be able to present myself in a better way. And the recovery, it's slow for me because of my memory loss, but I have people that are willing to help me, which is the people that I'm here with today. So I thank you.
Good evening. My name is Bill Toland. I'm a Recovery Association Project organizer, and I'm also I've had about a 25-year history with Department of Corrections as a consumer, and and most of that happened. I had criminality before I found drugs. I found drugs in prison, and because of the sentencing laws, the crimes that I always thought I was a pretty smart criminal because I was looking at the sentencing guidelines before I did a crime, and it kind of became a way of life. But there was no treatment. Way back in 1980, 1981, 82, there was no treatment in the prison system. And toward the end of the 80s, I was getting pretty tired of doing time. But I had I'd picked up a drug habit at that time. I'd been a methamphetamine user for, I think 1984 is when I started using methamphetamine. Speed the process up. I got 1997. I got my first possession of a controlled substance. They didn't special case factor 25 me, which is a law. I don't know if everybody in the room knows about it, but you're supposed to be, if you're a special case factor 25, you're supposed to do treatment before you're released from prison. I had a possession of controlled substance, and they wouldn't afford me treatment. I asked for it. I was ready to stop. I didn't get treatment. I'm not blaming that on the system, but what I do know from being in the prison system for 20-some-odd years is the thing that's going to help people is long-term, 6 months, 12 months, intensive supervision once they get out of prison. The drug courts, any kind of treatment program that affords transitional housing. That's a huge problem when you're coming out of prison and you don't have a place to live. The only thing you know is another crime. You're either going to go back and have a place to live, or you're going to have money to live on the streets. And that's the mindset of what's going on in the prison system. At least it was with me. What happened for me this time was there's a 6-month transitional program at OSCI that I came out of that helped me learn about budgeting, about, you know, that there was other options. There was a mentors program here in Marion County. I did everything I could to not come back to Marion County this time, and this is where I came. So I had set up a plan to go to college. Four classes and 140 internship hours away from taking my CADC test. So I'll be a certified drug counselor probably about November.
I'm already working in the field. But that's not why I'm here tonight. Why I'm here is basically just to share the information that transitional housing and treatment are what we've got to try to do. The high-level meth cooks and stuff, they should be in prison. But the users, there's got to be a way to afford them treatment. OHP's going away. I know probably numerous people in the room have heard a lot of us at Recovery Association Project talking about, please don't take OHP away. But there's a lot of people that aren't receiving treatment, and that's why this meth problem is just escalating. There's no treatment for people. So basically, I think the drug courts, that's a huge plus. If we can put any money out of the state budget into that. Today I'm a taxpayer. I'm 45 years old and just started paying taxes for the first time. And, you know, that's huge. So, you know, it's my way of trying to give back to the community is, you know, if any of you guys ever have any questions, call Recovery Association Project. My name is Bill Toland. I'm free to give any kind of information that you guys might want, you know, if I can help. Thank you.
My name's Jody, and I'm a cocaine addict. I'm a little different from the meth because I have ADH, and so for me to do meth was like medicating myself, doing nothing. So I found the other end of it, which was cocaine. And I'm also a current member of Marion County Adult Drug and a member of treatment. And I know that if I had gotten probation, because I'd never been in trouble, I got a possession of a controlled substance in January of last year, and it changed my life, you know. But if it weren't for the judge offering me a diversion program, you know, at first it was, all right, I don't get a felony, I get to keep the job with the state. But then it was like, well, I don't need the job with the state because I need to work on who I am. And so I gave it up. And today I have a job. I just got a job after 15 months in recovery. And it took me that long to become a productive member of society again. And it's through Marion County Adult Drug Court. It's through the intensive treatment. I'm in aftercare, getting ready to graduate this program. And I wouldn't change a thing, but if 15 months ago somebody had said, go take probation, I probably would have been in and out of the jails. I'd probably still be a cocaine addict, probably dead. I wouldn't have a family life with my mother. I wouldn't have friends. I wouldn't know about any recovery association where any of the anonymous rooms were or nothing, you know. So I believe that Marion County Adult Drugs or any drug court needs funding, and I see people every day now be turned away because our funding is going away, and I happen to be one of the lucky ones that got in on the federal grant, and with my Oregon health plan it has helped me, but otherwise I wouldn't be able to pay for treatment. It needs to be cost effective for the addict, you know. And I live in an Oxford house. I don't live out in the society yet. I live in a clean and sober Oxford house, which is a very beneficial place that the judge is one of the things that our judge makes us do. And it gives us a way to learn to budget our money and pay our rent, but yet have a safety net. So, you know, for me to watch the newcomer today come in and say, I can't, I take him aside and say, I said, I can't. And here I am today, 15 months later, clean and sober, not having a desire to use drugs. And it took me almost 4 months to get my brain back to be able to say, okay, I'm not drug affected, I have ADH, let's go and figure it out and get medical care and all those things that I never did as an addict. I never went to the doctor. I didn't care. You know, today I go to the doctor when I'm sick, or, you know, and I tell them I'm an addict, don't give me narcotics, and I go for the non-narcotic drugs, or if I can't, just something over the counter. And I believe that, you know, the legislator is working hard to curb the drug problem, but it's out there every day, and I know I'm trying to change it as one addict to another addict to let them know. So thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Katie Suver, Walt Veglin, and Mark McDonald. I don't know if I got them right.
Chair Burdick, Chair Krieger, members of the committee, my name is Walt Beglaw. I'm the district attorney for Marion County, and I speak on behalf of the Oregon District Attorneys Association this evening. I think we can all agree that no other phenomenon has impacted public safety more than the epidemic of meth. Meth has infected the day-to-day efforts of law enforcement, social services, business, and every single facet in our communities. And today, as I speak every evening in different public communities, no citizen can claim to be left untouched by meth. With its crippling addiction, as we have heard, its ease of manufacture, and its lucrative profits to dealers. Most importantly, and I think we started here with Chief Myers, most importantly, our children are suffering dearly from this epidemic. The enforcement piece is a critical component of our effort to combat meth. No one has worked harder, as I look out across the Legislative Assembly here this evening, no one has worked harder to address methamphetamine than you. And these committees, and Governor Kulongoski, as evidenced by his meth task force recommendations, all of these efforts, along with the community efforts, are the direction we need. These features are vital, as evidenced in these two bills. The authors of Senate Bill 907 and House Bill 2485 have prioritized this effort, and we acknowledge that commitment, recognizing that it attempts to honor the fiscal challenges of the biennium budget. The enforcement packages in here, as we read them, are beginning in the right place, with sentencing enhancements on basically meth cooks. But as prosecutors, as practitioners, they simply do not go far enough. There must be a greater price to pay for manufacturing meth in Oregon. From this day forward, for those who choose to poison our communities and our children with methamphetamine, we believe that the narrow scope contemplated will have a negligible enforcement impact on those who manufacture meth in Oregon. We also believe that this effort is only the beginning, and it's a step forward. It's a step forward in an engaged and focused way. It's a balanced agenda for years to come that we will be together fighting methamphetamine. And again, I think we can all agree we fight a monumental fight, defined boldly by the generational impact described here visually and audibly today on the impact of Oregon and its children. Let me briefly go off script. As District Attorney of Marion County, I come to you in desperate resolve. During the first quarter of 2005, two enforcement teams of Chief Myers, the DART team and the community response team, pulled 151 children into protective custodies out of the homes described by Anna Peterson that she's been in. They could not live in these homes. The escalation of children living in these environments is phenomenal and frightening to me as district attorney. We are on pace, and these are two teams that are looking for these children, and these are two teams that only function in one police department in my county. We are on pace to pull 1,000 children out of these homes, meth homes, in Marion County in 2005. Just recently, they described a child to me who was an infant that was diagnostic of induced psychosis described by Craig Campbell of meth bugs. A baby was having meth bugs. We must, as I continue off script briefly, we must drive a balanced and realistic, with realistic expectations as we put together this package. And all the elements are there. The enforcement piece, the treatment piece, and the drug courts that are fostered are phenomenal ideas. The prevention piece, I can't emphasize, and one of the questions here was about civil forfeiture. We've got to fund enforcement teams in a drug endangered child model or an enforcement model for interdiction. And a final piece that I can't get anyone to look at, and I've got to work harder at, is potentially a meth assessment for manufacturers and deliverers, like a Chapter 163 assessment, because they have cash that we can use to circulate and fund programming such as drug courts. Another good self-sustaining idea. So let me end with that piece. It has to be a balanced approach, and I appreciate the time. I'm going to turn over to Mark McDonald from Multnomah County to kind of, I think, expand on some of the concerns we have as an association.
Chairman Krieger, members of the committee, my name is Mark McDonald. I'm a senior deputy district attorney in Multnomah County. I have been the supervisor for the drug unit in Multnomah County for the past 8 years, which includes running Oregon's first drug court. And I am a strong proponent of drug courts. We try to channel every user that we can get into the program. And we do not use incarceration in Multnomah County. We do not have a jail for those types of individuals. Our plea officers offers are simply probation with no jail and ask that they be treatment, knowing full well that they'll probably be case back and not get into treatment. We do everything we can to get people into STOP, which is our drug court program. We used to have a second drug court program called Clean Court, which was a mandatory program for people who were placed on probation, but we lost our federal funding for that program, so we just have a STOP court. But let's be honest, there is no silver bullet to the meth problem. Drug court is great, but it's not appropriate for all offenders. There also needs to be appropriate sanction for meth cooks. I always tell people that the meth crisis epidemic is a two-headed monster. The Mexican cartel, which is responsible for somewhere between 50 and 80% of the methamphetamine consumed in Oregon, and the small toxic labs, which are responsible for something between 20 and 50%. It varies at different times and different locations. Realistically, there's very little that we can do about the Mexican cartel to interrupt the smuggling of methamphetamine and those precursors into our community. To a large extent, we're at the mercy of the federal government. And we need to urge the federal government to step up the plate and do more. They can do more. They need to do more. We can, though, impact, if not completely eliminate, the problem of the small toxic labs. In my estimation, there's only about 200 or 300 active meth cooks in the state of Oregon. That's based upon analysis of the cases in my county and knowing that we are typically 40% of all felony cases in the state. That is a relatively small number of individuals considering the dramatic impact that they cause in our community, the thousands and thousands of dollars. I know the Oregon State Police did analysis for the Oregon Pharmacy Board that said that every meth lab that's discovered costs taxpayers approximately $19,000. There's other studies that show that it's many times that, a study out of L.A. We need to take decisive action and to say that if you cook methamphetamines, you are going to go to prison. Ladies and gentlemen, those of us that are on the front line are dying. We're drowning. My office, my unit, prior to civil forfeiture had 12 deputies, and now we're down to 7. My deputies each have between 75 and 200 open, active, pending cases. There is no way that we can respond inadequately to those types of cases. We are drowning. We are losing the battle. We need your help. We need a tool to put these people that are bringing this calamity upon us
into prison. Otherwise, we can have all the treatment in the world, and I strongly recommend that we fund more treatment. But we need to take decisive action where we can. Thank you.
Good evening, Chair Krieger, members of the committee. My name is Katie Suver. I'm a deputy district attorney in Marion County. I work for Mr. Begloff. I'm also the HIDTA prosecutor for Marion County. I'll try not to use that acronym too much. High intensity drug trafficking area. It's a federal designation, and it means that Marion County obviously has a lot of drugs moving through it. The bill, I will have to apologize. I only found out about the hearing yesterday because I have been in a trial. Luckily, I was able to review a portion of the bill, and there is one portion of it that I would like to talk to the committee about. In the language of the bill itself, our major concern is the creation of a new category of drug offender. That is the person who is delivering or manufacturing at least 30 grams of an ingestible or marketable form of methamphetamine. Our concern on that front is twofold. First of all, ingestible or marketable form of methamphetamine is not defined that I could find anywhere in the statute. Therefore, it's left up to interpretation. Does that mean that there is a quantitative analysis of the methamphetamine that has to be done? In other words, do our state police crime labs, who are already burdened and somewhat underfunded, are they now going to be required to do a quantitative analysis to determine what the purity of a particular substance is? Or does it refer to the fact that the methamphetamine has to be in usable form? In other words, when the police officers make entry into a methamphetamine lab and discover that there is a solution, perhaps, or a sludge that contains methamphetamine, is that or is that not calculated in this marketable or usable form? So that's our first concern, is just the lack of definition of what that means.
Could I just interrupt briefly? I'm not sure what bill you're speaking to. You just said the bill.
I apologize. It's the Senate Bill 907.
Okay. I thought we had open hearings on both, so I wasn't sure.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you.
Okay. The second concern obviously relates to a fiscal one. A couple of years ago, as prosecutor, it used to be that when police officers either went into methamphetamine labs or did drug investigations of any kind, the evidence was automatically sent to the state police crime lab. Prosecutor didn't have to do anything to request it. It was automatically tested. A couple of years ago, due to budget cuts, the crime lab basically told us and all the other district attorney's offices, we can't test all the drugs that you have now. You can't automatically send them down to us. That put a little bit more of a burden on prosecutors, because now we have to affirmatively request that drugs get tested. And again, that's just sort of another thing that we have to deal with when we're preparing for trials and when we're preparing for cases. What our concern is regarding, again, the definition of at least 30 grams of an ingestible or marketable form of methamphetamine, is that that could be interpreted as requiring a quantitative analysis. And I hope if any of you have questions about what that definition is as far as quantitative analysis, I'd be happy to talk to you a little bit more about that. In the federal system, there is a distinction between a mixture or substance containing a detectable amount of methamphetamine and a certain amount of actual methamphetamine. And obviously the federal government has the funding to be able to do that type of quantitative analysis in their crime labs. I don't believe that our state crime labs have the ability to do that type of quantitative analysis in each case involving methamphetamine. And our concern is that although this provision may be in Senate Bill 907, it's not something that routinely we will be able to enforce, because we won't have the money or the funding to ask our crime lab to consistently do quantitative analysis. While we are very pleased with the fact that the committee and Senate Bill 907 is looking at addressing specifically increasing the crime seriousness of manufacturing methamphetamine, which at this time, I've had the opportunity down in Coos Bay to at least explain to certain members of the committee what manufacture of methamphetamine typically is on our sentencing guidelines. at this juncture in the state of Oregon, if you manufacture methamphetamine, the presumptive sentence, if you don't have any other criminal history, is 24 months of supervised probation. In other words, there is a minimal sanction for those people who choose to manufacture methamphetamine. Even, again, under our current sentencing guideline scheme, if you are a repeat meth manufacturer, still the presumptive sentence is 24 months of supervised probation. The only thing that changes that is if you happen to have a prior felony person crime conviction or prior misdemeanor person crime conviction. Our proposal, the Oregon District Attorneys Association proposal at Coos Bay, which we presented, would have increased the crime seriousness of the manufacture of methamphetamine to a crime seriousness 8, regardless of the quantity of methamphetamine that the lab itself is capable of producing. And while I wish that we had the funding through our state police crime laboratories to do the type of forensic analysis to determine what quantity a lab is capable of producing, I'm confident just from my day-to-day practice of prosecuting these cases that we don't have that type of funding. And quite frankly, at a certain point, as Mr. McDonald pointed out, with the lack of prosecutors in Multnomah County, I know in Marion County, there just aren't enough hours in a day. You just can't get the work done. So what we would urge on Senate Bill 907 is that there be further discussion or at least consideration of whether or not to keep that particular provision in the bill. Perhaps the compromise is instead of making the manufacture of this increased quantity of methamphetamine a crime seriousness 9, perhaps the committee would consider adopting the Oregon District Attorneys Association original proposal of making all manufacturers of methamphetamine a crime seriousness 8, again, regardless of the quantity. Thank you.
Senator Ringo.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question, not so much for the panel, but perhaps for one of the members of the work group, you, Mr. Chair, one of the others, or maybe even our committee staff, I guess responding to the concerns they raised, and including the letter from Mark McDonald about his letter expresses disappointment that the sentencing isn't more stringent. And testimony just was 24 months of probation for the first manufacturing meth. Does seem incredibly light. And I'm just wondering if somebody could share with us the reasoning behind that relatively light sentencing. Is it simply a matter of resources that if we up the penalty, we don't have any place to put these people, or are there other factors involved?
Do you want me to go ahead? Senator Ringo, to answer the specific question about the manufacturing of the manufacturing being a level 4, Senate Bill 907 in the Dash 3 amendments does direct the Criminal Justice Commission to raise the manufacture of methamphetamine as long as it's a cook involved as opposed to relabeling, repackaging, labeling, and packaging. So if it's a chemical reaction cook involved in the manufacture, we have directed the Criminal Justice Commission to raise that to a level 6 offense. The presumptive sentence for a level 6 offense is presumptive probation of 36 months for the first, basically, three or fewer criminal, if you have three or fewer felonies, non-person felonies. If you've got a person felony, or once you start getting into sort of that repeat drug and property stuff, you're over into some presumptive prison. Additionally, in that repeat offender scheme that I alluded to in my staff measure summary, if an individual has a prior meth-related offense, which is a manufacturer delivery within 1,000 feet of a school, or possession of a precursor substance, so they've got one of those priors, regardless of whether they show up on the presumptive probation or the presumptive prison side, their minimum sentence, presumptive sentence, is going to be a 19-month prison sentence. And if their presumptive prison box is larger, then they will get the presumptive prison box. And the 19-month number that the committee came up with for some of those repeat offender was not pulled out of the air entirely. It was the results of some discussions with the Department of Corrections, who told us more about their alternative incarceration programs. And 19 months is about the minimum period of time where it becomes beneficial to the department and the inmate to have this alternative incarceration program where the individual has a 6-month
in custody, inpatient treatment and cognitive restructuring program, and then 3 months of aftercare and transitional housing. If at any time the individual messes that up, they get pulled back in, and they serve every day of the remainder of their sentence. Otherwise, they get out, and they have that sort of carrot and stick approach. So we did not do the mandatory minimums that would not allow for the individuals to participate in those alternative incarceration programs. Instead, the work group decided that what was more appropriate was to do those 19-month repeat offender sentences with the hope that DOC would get enough funding to increase their treatment beds and more people would be funneled through their alternative incarceration program.
Just to follow up, Mr. Chair, I'm not sure I followed everything you said. In fact, I'm pretty sure I didn't. But I think you made a distinction between people cooking meth and people otherwise involved in repackaging or distributing, and that cooking was going to warrant the more stringent sentencing. I just am responding to the concerns they raised that the overall sentencing just isn't strict enough. And some of the other testimony we heard said for the users, treat them. The users need treatment. But the people involved in the manufacture, the distribution, they need to be hammered. And I haven't studied this nearly as much as you folks have, and I tend to defer, although I do take very seriously the comments that they've made. And I am not one to automatically jump on the DA bandwagon for increased sentencing. But given the magnitude of this problem, I take their comments very seriously.
If I might respond, Senator Ringo, members of the committee, a level 6, unless a person has a prior person conviction, is still a local sentence. Even if they get a prison sentence, it's a maximum of 12 months, which has to be served locally. And I would point out that in our recommendation, we did not recommend mandatory minimums. What we simply asked was the court to impose, or that the court be required to impose the presumptive sentence, so that there would be the possibility of these alternative treatment programs. What is important is not the severity of the sentence for meth cooks, but the certainty, because these are people that are involved in a premeditated, calculated crime. They're taking business risks. Most of these people are motivated for financial reasons. Some do it for power. Some do it for status among their associates. But this is a risk that they consciously make. And unlike other types of criminals, we can really make a difference with these people.
And Senator Ringer may also respond briefly regarding just sort of a follow-up to what Mr. McDonald said. I think also in response to your question, Senator Ringo, and perhaps in response to some of the comments made by Ms. Moad, the practical effect of the crime seriousness of the manufacture of methamphetamine being only a level 4 at this point, a lot of times as prosecutors, we try to get a little creative. The Criminal Justice Commission saw fit to designate the possession of a precursor substance with the intent to manufacture as a crime seriousness 6. The police officers are able to discover a lab, be it in the trunk of a car, a hotel room, or in somebody's home subsequent to an investigation. I have yet to find one that did not possess or have a precursor substance. In other words, there will be some iodine matrix, there will be some red phosphorus, there will be some precursor substance. And as a prosecutor, that is what we have turned to prosecuting people for, because at least if we prosecute them for possessing a precursor substance with the intent to manufacture it, it'll be a crime seriousness 6. While I think the general public thinks of the term manufacture of methamphetamine to be a more serious crime, the practical reality is it just isn't. And what we are hoping is that this committee and in this legislative session, the legislature recognizes that we absolutely must increase the crime seriousness of the manufacture of methamphetamine, period, regardless of how much they're manufacturing, and without the necessity for the state police crime lab and the police officers to do that dangerous job of
parsing out samples and taking enough so that they can actually do a quantitative analysis.
Thank you. I just appreciate those comments, and it sounds completely appropriate to me.
Can I ask a question?
Mr. Chair, how much more severe is the problem with the children in terms of the effect of children? It seems like this addiction has such a much more severe impact on the welfare of children. To what degree is it been documented so much worse than cocaine or other different?
I think you heard, if you were in Pendleton, the testimony of James Gerhardt from Rocky Mountain Haida, and he talked about the Jewish National Center study that the toxic levels of the different chemicals that are released are way beyond what is allowed in industrial standards. Many of these are immediately dangerous to life and health. And what these studies showed is that what happens is that they're released during the action, and they go out throughout the entire residence, the entire place, and they land on all surfaces where children walk. And if you've been a parent, you know that the children pick everything up and put it in their mouths. And we have a lot of children. We've developed endangered child protocols in Multnomah County and other places. We have children tested, and they come back positive for methamphetamine a lot. And what Dr. Martini, who conducted the study, is, and it just makes sense, is that these are smaller people. They have developing motor systems, skills. It impacts them much worse. And the problem is that these chemicals remain in these places until they're cleaned up.
Can I follow up, Mr. Chair? I guess I'm more interested in is, we are hearing so much about the Child Protective Services, how many children are found to be abused, and so much more than other drugs. And I'm wondering if it's just the prevalence of, or just the rate of addiction of this drug, why are we hearing so much more about the effect on children in these homes, more so than others?
I think there's a couple of reasons. One is that methamphetamine, the culture, the drug, is fundamentally different than other hard drugs like heroin and cocaine. You've heard that there are as many women users as there are men, and that brings them into this very dangerous setting. It also tends to be a communal type setting. There's a lot of people living in these places, and they're in and out. And there's sort of a cabal of thieves. These are people, they're not crashing like on heroin or after they use cocaine. These are people that are up for 4 or 5 days. They're very busy, energetic, and committing other crimes. And I just think it's the whole culture, just because there's so many women using it. There's a communal situation. It's just a fundamentally different drug.
Final question, Mr. Chair. And I think what you've touched on is I think when I look at all this data that all this task force have provided, it's startling given the number of female users, and not only women but young women, and the rate of increase among girls 17 and under. And if we know this so markedly to be true, and then we can even go into the more the demographics, it seems like women who are living economically marginalized lives, 30% of them on public assistance, poor women. So if we know, I think that's why we're seeing so many kids affected, because women have kids. And so what are we doing in terms of the prevention? How are we targeting this population to do a little bit of the controlling the problem through demand as opposed to supply?
Well, I think you've heard part of it here today with our drug courts. We're really trying to use those. In my county, we've had an active drug court for 15 years. That's been an important part. We've done education programs. We've developed drug endangered child protocols. We've got DHS involved from the very beginning. There is a tremendous amount of communication now between the police and the prosecutors and DHS. Before they go out and raid a place, if they think there's children there, they get a DHS worker there. very beginning. They try to do their execute their search warrants when the kids aren't in the home, so they don't have to go through the trauma of execution of search warrant. That is a very, very violent, traumatic experience. You know, we're just sort of starting this area. We need to do more. I mean, there's a lot of things more than we can do than what we're doing. But, you know, with the resources that we have, we're doing the very best we can.
But can I, just a clarification. We're not doing anything specifically than targeting it to women, poor women, and young women.
Chair, Representative, I believe we are. We are absolutely colorblind to the effort in terms of the alignment between the public safety sector and your social services and all these different opportunities within our community, with our relief nurses, with public and private organizations such as No Meth, Not in My Neighborhood, your schools, the courts. We're trying to align that effort, and we're focusing in on that vulnerable population as we look to care for those kids and the mother of those kids. And so it's quite a battle, but we are there in that battle.
Hey, Senator Walker, you had a question?
I did. I almost forgot it. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate all the questions of my colleague. I had a question about the federal government's role. I've been a court reporter for 22 years, and when I did court reporting for federal grand jury some years ago, we prosecuted a lot of methamphetamine dealers, manufacturers, and they went to federal prison. So it didn't put the person in state prison on state funds. Are we still doing that, and is the federal government being a partner in this area?
Chair Senator Walker, I'll be happy to answer that. Perhaps you read recently about a recent case that was done by the resident DEA office here in Salem. The office investigated, pursuant to a month-long investigation, a super lab that was actually found in Linn County but found in the state of Oregon that resulted in the arrest and, as I was told yesterday by the federal prosecutor on the case, an indictment of over 10 individuals who were involved in the conspiracy to manufacture methamphetamine. That particular super lab had the capacity of 90-pound productions. It was right here. And there are still federal prosecutions. Although I am cross-designated as an assistant United States attorney and I do some federal drug prosecutions, obviously there is a greater threshold. They typically look at international or at least interstate type of drug commerce. They look to see whether there are other implications such as money laundering, such as firearms trafficking or possession.
Well, and you can find that in almost every case.
Well, certainly to a certain degree and to a certain scale, I would agree. I mean, if you're selling drugs, you're not likely declaring that drug money on your taxes. So I agree to a certain level that's the case. Mm-hmm. But my experience with the United States Attorney's Office in Oregon is that they are looking for higher-end, upper-end dealers and manufacturers. And if you will, unless there is someone who is a career offender or someone who is actually caught for maybe their fifth or sixth time and they happen to have a quantity that is significant enough to get a significant penalty in the federal system, that might be the type of person that I'm able to prosecute in the federal system. So for the day-to-day law enforcement that happens in our community, the hundreds of people that are arrested for drug offenses every month in possession of methamphetamine, who are dealing street-level quantities of methamphetamine, who are conducting or manufacturing the tweaker labs, I think we've called them before, those are the people who are prosecuted by our offices.
If I might add just a little bit, Senator Walker, our police try to sell these cases, the bigger cases, to the feds. They actually go there and try to get them to prosecute them. And I also say that U.S. Attorney for the District of Oregon, Karen Immigrant, is a close friend of mine, and she's asked me, well, why don't you guys get some deputies cross-designated to come over here and prosecute cases in federal court? Well, the dilemma in my office is that we are so overwhelmed, we're actually choosing whether or not are we going to prosecute these cases to try to get them to go through the stop court. and get these people treatment? Or are we, you know, or what case are we going to do or what case are we not going to do? We have increased our declining of cases by 10%. We've gone from 20% to 30% of rejecting cases. We don't have the resources to cross-designate somebody to go over and prosecute cases in the federal system. We'd love to, but we just, since civil forfeiture was defeated, we've lost almost half of our drug unit.
Representative Girard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick comment based on the testimony we've been listening to. I just would like to add my concerns to the concerns that Senator Ringo expressed to the committee, and that this committee, I believe, should review the sentencing guidelines that are in Senate Bill 907.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, that was my point of my question about the federal government, because the sentences are much longer. Mm-hmm. And if we can put the manufacturers and the dealers in the federal prison and we can deal with the treatment and the everyday user that we see here, I think that's more effective. But apparently we even have trouble doing that.
Okay, especially on the small quantities.
Right.
Okay. Senator Burdick, you had a question.
Yeah, it was actually pertaining to your comment about forfeiture, and that is, I mean, obviously one of the reasons that the sentences aren't higher is because just the recognition of the budget realities that we're facing. We did spot the discrepancy between the level 4 for the manufacturing and the level 6 for the precursors, and at least we fixed that. But my question to you is, we've got a forfeiture revision percolating its way through the process, and if we don't have the resources to make significant changes in the sentencing, how much good do you think a change in the forfeiture law would do in terms of the manufacturing?
I know, again, from my own experience, the Portland Police Bureau and the Multnomah County Sheriff's Office, they've started to focus on the 10 most active crooks in Multnomah County, and they've been able to identify those. If we had more deputies, we would have those deputies working hand in glove with those people and, you know, putting a lot of attention on those particular cases and helping them write search warrants, answering their legal questions, really being dogged on those people because they have such an impact on our community. But again, you know, as a supervisor of that unit, I have to decide what we're going to prosecute or where I'm going to send my people. I mean, they are working very hard, and I can't wait to get Ms. Moad back.
You can't have her. No.
You might not have her for 18 months. Get ready.
But, I mean, those are the types of decisions. I mean, if we had more resources, we could be more effective. And the problem is that the prosecutor's office is at the hub of this whole system.
But what about forfeiture? I mean, if there were, you know, there's thought in among some people that the court is likely to throw out the constitutional amendment that severely restricted forfeiture, and if there's some limited or maybe even expansive return to civil forfeiture, do you feel that will be
most definitely prior to Measure 3, my office sees in excess of $1 million per year that came to Multnomah County. Most of that went to the law enforcement, the seizing agencies. My office got approximately 30% of that money. That averaged about $400,000 a year for my office that paid for the 5 deputies that are now missing.
We're getting kind of short on time here. I have Representative McPherson, and we're going to have a little conversation where we're going to have to go with the hearing.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. As a member of the meth work group, I'm feeling a little defensive about the suggestion that we were being timid in our response to sentencing for drug manufacturing. I just wanted to focus on that for a moment. Our recommendation was to elevate manufacture from a level 4 to a level 6. If that's just for regardless of the timing, but then the special repeat offender, so that on the second offense it would be a 19-month prison sentence, and that doesn't strike me That's a timid response, but I want to get your reaction. You're saying it should be 19 months on the first offense, or where should we have gone?
Well, what we're, first of all, on a level 6 absent a prior person felony conviction, that's a probationary sentence. Essentially, what you're saying is if you're a cook, you get 2 bites of the apple. I guess I disagree with that. There's a huge difference between a user and a cook. You make a huge leap there. It's a conscious, premeditated, calculated decision. And based upon the destruction and the cost to the taxpayers of Oregon that these people, relatively few in number, cause, they should go to prison. And a small cook, for all intents and purposes, is just as dangerous, just as hazardous as a large cook. Because large cooks usually happen in a rural area, some farmland or some remote area. These small cooks are happening in our community, in urban areas, in houses, apartments, where innocent people come in contact with. That's where we're finding all these children, are in these small, what we refer to as Beavis and Butthead labs. We're not finding them in the big super labs. We're finding them in the small ones. And one of those small labs costs several thousand dollars to clean up, untold social costs. Yes, based upon the calamity that they've brought upon our state, yes, they should go to prison.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
We're having the discussion of who's going to tell them we're going to start this back up tomorrow. There's some people we didn't get to here from the Department of Human Resources, Board of Pharmacy, Western Prison Project, Kevin Mannix, and Miller. How many of you can get back tomorrow? Who can't get back tomorrow? Raise your hand.
He's Western Prison Project. She's carrying me on DHS.
Okay, why don't we just have the two of you come up? We're going to give you until a quarter after.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Go ahead and state your names. Everyone wants to start first. And like I say, you've got about 4 minutes apiece. Five.
Thank you, Chair Krieger, Chair Burdick, and members of the committee. My name is Karen Wheeler, and I'm the Addictions Policy and Program Development Manager with the Office of Mental Health and Addiction Services, and thank you for letting me speak. Technically on vacation, but I believe so much in drug courts that I'm here tonight. I just want to say that I'm going to make a few comments about House Bill 2485, the proposed amendments to House Bill 2485. Section 25 directs the Criminal Justice Commission to implement a plan to reduce drug problems. And I just want to say that the office is very supportive of these amendments and that we will do whatever we can to work with the Criminal Justice Commission to develop criteria, develop the guidelines, to review grant applications, to provide technical assistance to treatment providers and drug court teams throughout the state. We already have staff in place that can work with the Criminal Justice Commission on this, and I would personally dedicate my time to do this as well. We believe in drug courts because they do work. You've already heard a number of presentations about the data, about the research. I believe they work because they have contingency management, they have case management, long-term treatment, recovery support services. Treatment does work, but we need to protect our investment in treatment by providing recovery support services and a longer period of time for people to get their lives back together. One comment that I have in Section 25, page 24, line 2, we would recommend to include community mental health.
Is that on the 907 or the 2485?
2485.
Thank you.
We would recommend to include community mental health programs and treatment providers in that sentence. Community mental health programs provide both mental health treatment and addiction treatment, and they subcontract with treatment providers in their local communities. And this would be one way to have a more coordinated approach with mental health so that people with addictions and mental illnesses can receive an integrated type of treatment. And that's all I have to say. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Krieger, Chair Burdick, committee members, my name is David Rogers, and I'm the Associate Director of the Western Prison Project. We're a regional nonprofit 501c3 that's dedicated to developing safe and sensible criminal justice policies that save taxpayers' dollars, that reduce recidivism, and that protect public safety. And we deeply appreciate the work that you've done. It's been very thoughtful in both House Bill 2485 and Senate Bill 907. It's a very balanced approach to a very difficult and challenging problem in terms of the meth epidemic here in the state. We're particularly pleased that you're providing funding for the establishment of drug courts, and there's been a lot of conversation about the proven success of drug courts, so I won't go on there. We are concerned that there hasn't been a dollar amount attached to that funding, and clearly for their success, proper funding is vital. And we're concerned that without that funding, that there could be a severe strain on the prison and jail systems if those who are eligible for drug courts have no place to go. In that sense, we recognize that counties have the ability to establish fees for the participation of drug courts. And we wonder if it makes sense to establish a system, or at least make it clear that fees in certain cases should be waived. If our system of drug courts is only open to those who can't afford it, then the indigent population, the very group that may benefit the most from drug courts because they are low-level users, may not have access to this important diversion program. Similarly, we have concerns about the section of House Bill 2485 dealing with food stamps. Our research shows that there's already a clear mechanism at both the state and federal level to remove food stamps from people who abuse them by selling them or bartering them for money or for illicit drugs. In fact, those are prosecutable crimes. And we also know that there's revocation sanctions available if a person on post-prison supervision is abusing drugs. If a supervising agency has the right to deny food stamps based on only a, quote, reasonable belief that stamps have been traded, then we would be concerned that this could lead to situations where people on post-prison supervision are inappropriately punished in a way that would severely harm families and children. So we're unclear on what standard of reasonable belief, what that actually means. Is it preponderance of evidence? Does it mean that food stamps can be stripped from a person with children merely based on a suspicion of fraudulent use? So finally, this effort could actually be duplicative of systems and mechanisms that are already in place to provide that accountability. And if the committee decides to leave it in, then we ask that there be a clear mechanism in place that would allow appeals of the decision before the food stamps are actually removed, particularly when there are children and other family members that are impacted. I think that you heard from a number of people that folks who are trying to make a successful transition back into the community and to get off drugs need types of support like food stamps. And we also know that they have family members and children that can be seriously impacted. Overall, we thought that there was a great deal to support in House Bill 2485, and we really appreciate your work.
Representative Barker, you had a question.
Hey, just real briefly, Mr. Rogers, what is you don't need to speak for the project, Western Prison Project, but it sounds to me like we're trying to do a lot of treatment, but what do you think about 19 months for the first offender of the cook?
You know, I would say that in terms of sentencing enhancements involved in that seem to be mostly in Senate Bill 907, that I would really encourage the committee members to look at what not only the fiscal impact of sentencing enhancements are, but what type of projections that in terms of increased prison population and jail population the sentencing enhancements will create. It should be no new news that the Department of Corrections budget has been skyrocketing, and that in the next 8 years, the DOC budget is going to double to $2.4 billion. And in my mind, that's going to make your job of balancing a budget more and more difficult, actually now and in the future. And so safe and sensible sentencing reform and sentencing enhancements have to really be thought about in terms of the fiscal impact.
Thank you.
Anything further from the committee? Okay, thank you very much. I think we finished up for tonight, and we're due tomorrow in 3:57 at 1 p.m. Senator Burdick, do you have anything?
Good night, everyone. Thank you for a good hearing. We'll see you all tomorrow.
Thank you.
We're adjourned.